Of the Legislative Energy Commission to order. Given that it's a week and 2 days after the election, looking back, I cannot believe we scheduled this, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. We took a look at alternative fuel vehicles a little bit earlier this summer when we looked at electric vehicles, or perhaps it was in the spring. I don't remember. But there is definitely technologies we were leaving out and we wanted to take a closer look at. We are still leaving out technologies in terms of alternative fuel vehicles, and I hope that the commission will continue to look at this issue because I think it is an issue that has bipartisan interest and interest across the state of Minnesota about where is our transportation sector going. So today we're focusing on natural gas vehicles and emerging alternatives like hydrogen and DME, dimethyl ether. There will be materials on the website. Our last meeting, apparently my notes tell me here, that it was in March. That's when our electric vehicles meeting was. So just like that meeting, we'll put these meeting materials on the website. We're not going to move to approve minutes because we don't have any House members here. So we don't have a quorum, but we could get a report from the executive director.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your packet, there is executive director updates, as usual, to fill you in on what I have been doing over the last couple of months when we haven't met. The first on the list is the propane conversion strategies review. This was requested by the legislature last year during the height of the propane crisis. And we have been working to look at a number of different potential propane alternative technologies and what, if anything, the state of Minnesota could be doing to help people better access those. We had a conference call to discuss this with anybody interested on August 6th. We'll have another one next Friday, November 21st, and anybody who is interested is welcome to participate. Just get in touch with me, and I'll get you the call-in information. And then our December meeting is going to include an update on the propane situation this year. The next topic, Energy Future Framework. This is also directed from the legislature from the 2013 bill to develop a plan to transition Minnesota to clean energy. The Department of Commerce has been selected by DOE for a partnership on state energy planning, and they're in the process of negotiating that contract with DOE right now. We would be involved in that work. And we should also have more details for you in the December meeting on that. We've been involved with the National Governors Association, Clean Energy and Economic Development Policy Academy. Minnesota was one of four states, you'll remember, that were selected to align our economic development and energy policies. And Deputy Commissioner Robin Sternberg from DEED will be presenting on that in just a moment. And finally, I had the privilege of serving as a delegate on the Transatlantic Program for Young Technology Leaders in Germany, focusing on energy, smart grid, especially in energy storage, but generally on the energy transition that is happening in Germany, the technology developments that are going along with that, and policy developments, some of which are going well and some not as well. I've learned a lot of what Germany is doing that we might consider and a lot of things that we're doing here that would, I think, be beneficial there. And there is also in our packets a summary sheet of that delegation. I'd be happy to talk in more detail if anybody is interested. So finally on the bottom, if I just add, has a list of upcoming LAC meetings. There's a November 21st call. It's optional for members, but anybody on the commission or any stakeholders would be welcome to participate in that. And then our next final meeting for the year is December 10th.
Thank you. It's great having an executive director so that we can keep moving forward even when members are otherwise occupied. Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, Nanny, what's who's going to be on the conference call on the propane?
Madam Chair and Senator Tomasoni, there are a couple of legislators, and I can't remember off the top of my hand who RSVP'd, but I think it will be mainly stakeholders from the propane and other heating industries and advocates who are interested in an update on where we're at.
Is there a meeting here also that people will be sitting around the table and other people calling in, or it's just all conference?
It's all on the phone.
Okay.
Any other questions for members? Okay, with that, we'll call up Robin Sternberg from DEED. Thank you for coming this morning.
Thank you, and good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Commission. I'm Robin Sternberg, Deputy Commissioner at DEED, and this is Weston Merrick, also from DEED, who has helped provide support for this effort. I am here today to give you some highlights of the Minnesota's clean energy economy profile, and I think you've all received this report already. This research in this report is part of, as Annie mentioned, the Minnesota National Governors Minnesota National Governors Association Policy Academy effort that we've been undertaking. This is a cross-agency effort with the Department of Commerce, Department of Ag, the EQB, and others. And the purpose was to align our economic development and clean energy strategies for the state of Minnesota. Over the last year, the Minnesota NGA team worked closely with the private and public sector to identify, to better understand our clean energy economy and to identify ways to grow employment and wages and investment in clean energy. The NGA team is compiling the findings of the NGA effort into a report of strategic opportunities that we will be presenting to the governor's office in the next coming months. The main takeaways of this report are, first of all, that the clean energy sector and the market in Minnesota is really developing rapidly and has already come a long way to reduce our dependence on imported energy. And one statistic that I always like to talk about is that Minnesota imports about $18 billion in energy from other states around the country, including North Dakota, Montana, et cetera. So we're making progress to reduce our reliance on those imports, but we have a ways to go. The state of Minnesota has taken on and supported clean energy policies over the last decade or more, and that has also created a competitive advantage, and that's what the report shows us, is that Minnesota is a leader, and we are well-positioned to take advantage of the $1 trillion market, clean energy market opportunity that we have ahead of us in the next several decades. The other findings are really around the employment in clean energy. Employment has grown 7 times faster than the overall state employment from 2000 to 2014, and that these are really good jobs. The wages in the clean energy sector are 40% higher than the state average. Finally, the last main finding is that Minnesota is advancing innovation in clean energy sectors, and we are a national leader with strong patent and investment activity. So just to give you a little bit of a picture, we are not going to talk today about all the policies that have been put in place over the past several years around clean energy. However, we would like to point out and create a help quantify this in a couple different ways. The biofuel production capacity in Minnesota today has grown to the point where it is enough to replace traditional fuel for the equivalent of 1.7 million vehicles in 1 year. Another way to quantify where we've come over the past number of years is that our energy savings and our renewable electricity generation in Minnesota is equal to that which would power over 1.4 million homes in the state for 1 year. So quite significant. And then, you know, from DEED's perspective, we are very interested in looking at the trends in employment that have taken place over the last years, and this is really a lot of new information, new data that we've never had before at DEED, looking at what is the, how do we put our arms around the actual clean energy sector in terms of employment, wages, investment, and so forth. And just a couple slides to show you that our clean energy employment has grown 78% since 2000. And this graph illustrates that bio, solar, and smart grid employment has more than doubled since 2000, and that wind employment has quadrupled since 2000. And it also, this chart also is really helpful in showing that we've diversified our energy portfolio in terms of employment. And while we have the largest employment is in energy efficiency, and that's our most mature sector in clean energy, it has grown, but it's sort of stabilized at the moment, where you see the higher growth occurring in the renewable energy areas of bio, wind, solar, and smart grid. I think this is also a great slide to talk about that this is really good for business and for citizens in Minnesota, that having a more diversified energy platform will help overall stabilize our reliance on fossil fuel energy and prices, and over time will hopefully decrease energy pricing. So a more diversified energy portfolio will really help when we think about things like propane shortages, coal shortages. We have more sources of energy in the clean energy sector. It is a good thing for the state. This slide shows you the overall wages in the clean energy sector, and we've grown from about $600 million in 2000 to over $1 billion in 2013, and that's adjusted for inflation. Our payroll, again, $1 billion at this point. And also that wages are much higher, as I mentioned earlier, than the average wages in Minnesota. An average of $71,000 a year is what you find in the clean energy sector jobs versus about $50,000 in all jobs in Minnesota.
We have a question, if it's okay to interject with questions. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Deputy Sternberg. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to imagine what the type of employment would be for solar, wind, or smart grid, but what does energy efficient job include? What is the definition of that?
Energy efficiency, that sector has encompasses things like thermostats, products that help homes and buildings reduce the amount of energy that they use. So it's so that their use of energy is more efficient. And companies like Honeywell, 3M, those kind of companies produce those kind of products. And that's maybe you want to add a little bit more to that.
Absolutely.
Go ahead and state your name.
Yeah, Weston Merrick. I'm an analyst with Deep. Yes, about 33% of the jobs that are in energy efficiency are actually in installation and maintenance. So installing energy efficiency inside homes. We have HVAC systems for large employers. What's one of the things that's really great about those type of jobs is they tend to pay very high wages, but don't require four-year degrees in most cases. So we can send individuals to technical schools and get them a very high wage and get them employed in a fast-growing industry.
Senator Rosen, did you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's just kind of a thought that we're having problems finding kids to go into HVAC and plumbing and all those type of technical careers. So this will be interesting to follow what's going to happen with that. So.
In higher ed.
Madam Chair,
point.
Just
Senator
a follow-up.
Senjum.
The efficient energy efficiency, would that, for instance, also cover something like a furnace installer? I mean, many of us have gotten new furnaces, things like that.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Senator Marty and then Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, I wouldn't ask this except your deed, and I wonder how this compares to not average wages in the state, but average new job wages in the state, because I think it's probably even more dramatic there. I mean, 40% is a lot. Do you know what average wages of new jobs are in Minnesota right now?
Not, Senator Marty, not offhand, but we can certainly find that out, and I think it's a great question.
Mm-hmm. Senator Tomasoni.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So a third of the jobs are installers, and are they the ones that are making more than $71,000?
Installers make less than the average, but above the state average. So $71,000 is the average for the entire industry in all five sectors.
So there's a new solar manufacturing plant in my district, and I'm fairly certain that the production line doesn't make
even close to 50,000, who's making so much money?
So the wages are distributed, I mean, like any sort of distribution, we're going to have wages on the higher and lower end. Of course, on the higher end are the individuals with the four-year technical degrees. We find that the highest wages in any sector in Smart Grid, which makes sense, there's a lot of engineers, there's a lot of technical individuals. But we also found that the manufacturing wages in clean energy tended to be higher than the manufacturing wages for the state overall.
And how high are those wages?
I don't have those numbers offhand, but I can certainly look into
that. I can tell you for sure the people in the solar plant don't make even close to what they make in the mines. Mm-hmm. And so I'd really like to know where these statistics come from. I mean, if an average in the industry is 71,000, mm-hmm. and people are making 35, I think 35 is probably high, making solar panels, then the people up top must be making 250,000 in order to bring the average up to 71,000. I mean, I just kind of like to know how you get to that number, because it makes it sound like we're making really, really good jobs in this industry, and I don't know that they're that good.
Mr. Merrick, will you follow up with Senator Tomasoni on the methodology for those calculations?
I'd be happy to.
Thank you. Representative Bouguinius.
Thank you. Along the energy efficiency lines, can you break out in any way how much of this benefits the end result of efficiency, benefits homeowners versus the commercial sector?
It's a really great question. This report, that wasn't in the scope, but we do look into the overall size of the energy efficiency savings in the report. And the energy efficiency savings we look at are both residential and commercial. So we could, I'm sure those statistics are out there. I bet the Department of Commerce might be able to answer statistics like that.
Representative Bouguinius.
I think that would be something helpful for us to understand, because so much of our housing stock is obsolete when it comes to energy efficiency. And as a state, we need some goals. How are we going to make this obsolete housing stock no longer obsolete? So we don't have that as a goal yet, and it does seem that that's one of the things that we need to work on. And so having some basic data is necessary.
Absolutely.
To the extent you provide information in response to different member questions, if you want to go through Annie, she'll make sure that everybody gets it. Mm-hmm. So, Ms. Sternberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, and I think that the last area that we just wanted to highlight for you is that Minnesota is a leader in nationally in patents and investments. Our ranking for patents has risen from 20th in the country in 2004 to 8th. I'm sorry, we're now in ranked 8th in the country for patents, and Minnesota is also ranked 2nd in the country for clean energy technology investment. So our investment in clean energy technology has increased from $400 million in 2004 So Minnesota was second in venture capital spending for clean energy technology, and we are now at $400 million. We've had $400 million in investment over the last 10-year period from 2004 to 2013. I apologize. And so in conclusion, I know we had a short asked to make a short presentation today. The concluding remarks show us that Minnesota's market is accelerating. It has an upward trajectory. We have a competitive advantage to help us take advantage of the $1 trillion global market opportunity. We are producing really good-paying jobs. If there's any negative information or any concern out there, we did find out that many of the smaller companies are not yet exporting. And so even though we're on this upward trajectory, we have a long way to go where we can really capture this opportunity and do even more to accelerate the progress of the growth of these companies and so that we can participate more fully in the global market. That concludes my presentation. There is quite a lot of more information in this packet or in this report. It does outline for you the different types of jobs in the value chain for each of the sectors. So if you are interested in those installation jobs versus the engineering jobs, that you will find that information in the report. You will also find a breakout by region. So if you're interested in certain regions and what sort of jobs and wages exist in different parts of Minnesota, that is also captured in this report. And we would be happy to provide any more information that you'd like.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner. Clean energy, do you have any information on whether clean energy is more expensive? I would say clean energy or renewables is more expensive than your traditional baseload energy. Would you have information on that? Is that correct?
Ms. Sternberg.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. Each of the sectors are in a different phase of their maturity, and while it may be initially more expensive to have clean energy, there are financing tools that help try to equalize that, and across all these sectors, you know, they're in sort of different places. I was recently at a summit this summer where Dave Mortensen of Mortensen Construction said that they're really banking on wind because now it's more pricing is more reliable than other energy sources. So I can't answer that in just, you know, one sentence, but it's complex, and there are opportunities where that can be equalized, but we're not fully, you know, it's not completely at parity, obviously, otherwise, you know, we would be farther along.
Madam Chair.
Senator.
I think the wind would be comparable as long as the federal tax credit is available.
Exactly.
But I guess I'm just thinking the very high wages that clean energy do bring in, I think, do they correlate to the high expense of clean renewable energy, because it is more expensive. So just wondering if there's any information, any data on that particular. Mm-hmm.
The anecdotes we're hearing from stakeholders are that most of the time the wages are higher in these industries because it requires a higher level of skill, so a technical degree or a master's degree in engineering, and that's generally why we're seeing that level. The individuals that are higher in the field have a higher level of training or a higher level of skill.
Okay.
Thank
you.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, a question about the early stage development, R&D stuff. How much of that is a handful of big companies, the 3Ms, and how much of that is small entrepreneurial startup type of things?
Yeah, so
Mr. Mayor.
Senator Marty, one of the things that we found is, and this actually reflects the larger U.S. economy, one of the things we see are that big companies are often the driver for R&D and patenting because they have a very large capital stock. They're able to spend the time, the money, the effort to invest over very long periods of time. So a lot of our patenting is in big companies. Our top five, 3M, Emerson Process. We saw a lot, of course, from the University of Minnesota, which is a leader in smart grid. And those are some of our Honeywells as well were some of the largest in there. In the patenting section of the report, there is a list of the largest patenters over the last, I believe, 10 years. So you can kind of glance at that. But there are, as well, small companies that are bringing up the technology and that we're very excited to see.
Any further questions from members? Thank you for your presentation this morning, and we look forward to continuing to be in contact.
Thank you very much.
Our next presenter is from the National Conference of State Legislatures, Christy Hartman. I believe Ms. Hartman joined us in March as well and brought us really great information about what other states were doing in the field of electric vehicles. I want to say that the work that we did in the LEC led to some of Representative Garofalo's successful legislative work on electric vehicles. So thank you for returning. Your information was really valuable last time. We look forward to hearing what you've got for us this time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here today, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Christy Hartman, and I work in the energy program at the National Conference of State Legislatures. And, you know, we've had great involvement from Minnesota legislators at NCSL, but in case you aren't familiar, we're a bipartisan organization. We represent all legislators and legislative staff in the 50 states, commonwealths, and territories. And we're really here to serve as an extension of committee staff. We're available to do research. We offer all types of educational opportunities to further look at topics of interest to state legislators. And we do have a lobbying arm that lobbies on behalf of state interests. So today, I want to spend the next 30 minutes or so and briefly talk about kind of the benefits of alternative fuels and what we're seeing as the major barriers to vehicle adoption. I'll spend the most time looking specifically at natural gas vehicles, where we are with the technology and deployment efforts, and then for NCSL, what we are seeing from state legislatures at this point, and then quickly look at a couple of what could be considered disincentives, primarily through federal legislation. And then I know that you will have a hydrogen speaker later on today, but I wanted to just give a brief overview of hydrogen fuel cell technologies, look again at what states are doing, and then talk briefly on California's pilot program. So first, just looking at the general benefits of alternative fuels, you may hear this a lot, but investing in alternative fuels helps us diversify our transportation fuel. So right now we have a very not diverse transportation sector. About 93% of the transportation sector relies on petroleum. So there's this big push to invest in alternative fuels. Also, alternative fuels help us increase our energy security. You know, there's this effort to reduce dependency on foreign oil. By investing in alternative fuels, we can really focus in on our domestic sources, so all of the coal, oil, natural gas, renewables, and nuclear. And then lastly, alternative fuels help us decrease emissions. So, you know, it does depend on the alternative fuel technology and the vehicle in particular, but generally speaking, total emissions are reduced for alternative fuel vehicles when compared to gasoline. But at this point, there's quite a few barriers to vehicle adoption, and one of the biggest is the higher upfront costs of alternative fuel vehicles. So none of the alternative fuel vehicles available today have the economies of scale that gasoline has, so that becomes a real issue for adopting vehicles. There's also kind of paired with that is the lack of fueling infrastructure. So electric vehicles have really taken off in the last couple years. Charging stations have doubled since 2012, but some of the other alternative fuels, that fueling infrastructure just isn't in place in the U.S. yet. Also, the last two are kind of combined. You know, there's not as many vehicle options available. Electric vehicles, again, we've seen the most growth in the light-duty sector, so the passenger vehicles. I think there's around 22 different models of electric vehicles, but when we're looking at, say, natural gas or hydrogen, we're nowhere near that number. And then there's just a general unfamiliarity with the vehicle types, which can deter consumers from purchasing these vehicles or fleets switching to these newer technologies that they may be less familiar with. So really why I am here today is to talk about natural gas vehicles in particular. So, you know, why should states or why are states looking at incentives for natural gas. And first, as we all know, natural gas is this domestic abundant resource that we have. We've seen huge growth in the production of natural gas in recent years. All these technological advances like hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling have allowed access to all these resources that were previously uneconomical to develop. Also, natural gas provides a lower fuel price, which I will talk about in a later slide. And what we've seen so far is even though, you know, we've seen a lot of investments by fleets in natural gas vehicles, and even though the upfront costs are higher and you know, there's a lack of fueling infrastructure, we still see fleets looking at investing in natural gas vehicles. And, you know, one of the big issues, I guess, is that, you know, the fuel price is lower, and so it does make sense kind of in the long-term cost savings. Natural gas, like many of the other alternative fuels, has reduced tailpipe emissions when compared to gasoline or diesel. And then the last point, so the fuel safety of natural gas vehicles can be greater than or equal to that of what we see in conventional cars. And basically, you know, if a leak occurs in, say, a compressed natural gas vehicle, natural gas is lighter than air, so it dissipates. So there's less of a safety concern within the tank system. So I normally, when I'm looking at natural gas vehicles for NCSL, you know, I normally just talk in broad terms of natural gas vehicles, but there are a couple different systems. And so I just wanted to quickly compare compressed natural gas to liquefied natural gas. Compressed natural gas is stored in high-pressure tanks, usually around 3,000 to 3,600 PSI, whereas liquefied natural gas is stored as this kind of super cooled liquid. I believe natural gas or LNG is normally stored at around minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit. The energy density of compressed natural gas is about four times less than diesel, and LNG is about two times less. So, you know, this might be an actual issue for natural gas. One of the things with CNG, the tanks are really heavy. They require more space. They're a lot bigger than that of gasoline or diesel. Right now, there is the Honda Civic natural gas vehicle, and I think, according to Honda, the car can go about 220 to 250 miles on a tank of CNG. You know, if you look at the Honda Civic, just the gasoline version, it can go much farther, maybe 350, 380, and then the hybrid goes even farther of 500 miles on a tank. So there is a difference with natural gas. What we've seen so far is we've seen CNG across kind of the natural gas vehicle spectrum, so light, medium, and heavy-duty vehicles. But we're also seeing this new push for LNG, which I'll talk about in the next couple slides. But we're seeing LNG could be useful in the medium to heavy duty fleets. So first looking kind of at where we are with the market for natural gas vehicles, there's about 14.8 million natural gas vehicles worldwide. The U.S. only has about 112,000, so we lag well behind the worldwide numbers. But we are seeing some growth, as I mentioned, you know, primarily in CNG, but there is this kind of growing interest, especially among state legislators and state policymakers with LNG. And I should also point out, you know, right now what we see, and I'll talk about this more, but we don't see as many natural gas vehicles in the light-duty kind of passenger vehicle sector. But we see natural gas vehicles used a lot with transit buses or converting school buses to run on natural gas. Waste collection vehicles also have a pretty large natural gas fleet. And then the third area ends up being at airports that can either use their own fleets or really push private fleets to use natural gas. So as I mentioned, there's only a few natural gas light-duty vehicles available. That's the CNG in yellow, but there is growth. And I just wanted to include this slide as a comparison to the other vehicle types, you know, diesel, electric, and hybrid. And then, you know, we're just starting to see a little bit of a push for hydrogen. So here are some examples of the types of natural gas vehicles that are currently on the market. So in the light duty sector, that first picture is the Honda Civic natural gas. There's a few other vehicle options. General Motors has a couple, as well as I think Ford might be coming out with a light duty vehicle. What we primarily see so far is in this medium to heavy duty category. So as I mentioned before, transit, school buses, you know, we see a lot of different companies, which I think we may talk about later, but UPS looking at investing quite a bit of their fleet into converting to natural gas vehicles. And then, as I've already said, there's this growing interest in using LNG, whether it's for on-road or off-road purposes. So right now, there's about 750 public CNG fueling stations, which really across the U.S. is not that many. But as you can see, LNG is much less, about 100 stations in total. And I thought it was kind of interesting to look at CNG stations by state. So California and New York have the highest number of stations. You know, out of the 750, California has 264, so it's a pretty substantial number of stations in their state. Utah is also a pretty interesting example. Utah has really, the state, along with private businesses, have invested in this natural gas infrastructure. So we see a lot of charging stations in Utah. And then just generally when we're talking about the refueling infrastructure, it can take a variety of ways. It can be one fleet-specific refueling station. It can be adding maybe a CNG or LNG capability to an existing station, creating whole new CNG LNG stations, or looking into more home refueling devices. So as I've mentioned, there's this interest in building out and expanding the LNG infrastructure, which we don't have a lot of currently in the U.S. And so there's a few different private sector arrangements, public-private partnerships that have come about to really invest in LNG infrastructure. One of the first in 1995, the Interstate Clean Transportation Corridor was created, and that basically connects California's major cities to Salt Lake City, Las Vegas, and Reno, and enables kind of the heavy-duty trucking sector to be able to switch to LNG and refuel along those interstates in that region. So now they're up to coverage of about 1,800 miles of LNG fueling stations. Since that time, there's been a few other similar public-private partnerships. Texas has a regional program, Rocky Mountain Corridor, Colorado, Utah have another program, and then the I-75 corridor running from Michigan, Ohio, down to Florida. There's also, you know, we've seen a lot of involvement when it comes to natural gas vehicles from private industries. The map on this slide is a picture of what's called America's Natural Gas Highway, and it's really this effort to expand the LNG refueling stations across the U.S. So this came out, this goal came out in 2011. I think it, the plan is to provide about 150 LNG fueling stations. They'd be public access stations, and we would see them in about 33 states. I know this is a project that is happening currently. You know, I think they're a little bit behind on meeting their goals. So because I've talked about natural gas versus conventional gasoline, I just wanted to do a quick comparison of CNG to gas prices. And the main point is that you can see CNG has been fairly stable in recent years, and continuing forecasts expect that to stay pretty level. And no matter where you look in the U.S., CNG is cheaper than gasoline, and in some parts of the country can be as much as 40% to 60% cheaper. So for fleets, this could be a really great option if they're looking at fuel costs. So really what I focus on at NCSL is the types of incentives that states are currently considering to increase natural gas vehicle adoption. And similar to other types of alternative fuels, we see really a variety of incentives offered by states. One of the most popular, though, is financial incentives. There's all different types of options that states are implementing, trying to help bring down the upfront costs of natural gas vehicles, and also help establish the fueling infrastructure needed. More specifically to natural gas incentives, there's also an interest in procurements for fleets, and so there's a variety of ways states are looking at either mandating state fleets have a certain amount of natural gas vehicles or alternative fuel vehicles, and then ways that they're helping through usually monetary incentives, helping other fleets switch to natural gas. There's also plenty of incentives looking at promoting fueling infrastructure. You know, for natural gas vehicles, you know, it's widely accepted that since we lack this fueling infrastructure, that's where states can help promote. And then, you know, as I've said, there's not a lot of natural gas vehicles in the light-duty sector, but if that is an area that will grow, consumers tend to like basic incentives like HOV lane access or inspections or emissions exemptions. That tends to increase vehicle adoption, and it doesn't cost the state that much. So currently there's about 36 states that have natural gas vehicle incentives, and of those states, about 29 have enacted some type of financial incentive, whether it's a rebate or a voucher, a loan program, or a tax credit. And within that, at least 10 states have more than one financial incentive, so quite a few states either offer multiple rebates or a rebate and a tax credit that are there to help consumers switch over to natural gas. So I wanted to give just a couple examples. We see a lot more rebates for natural gas vehicles than we do for electric vehicles, and this may be that natural gas vehicles have not entered the consumer market as much as electric vehicles have, at least in the light duty sector. So there's all different types of kind of rebates and vouchers that states are offering. So I put the Illinois example, up to $4,000 for purchasing or converting a vehicle to natural gas. So that's a pretty substantial amount of money that would entice customers to purchase natural gas vehicles. Oklahoma, the Oklahoma Natural Gas Utility offers its own $1,000 rebate. So this isn't a state rebate, but we see quite a few utilities offering their own programs to incentivize natural gas. Tax credits are also fairly common across alternative fuel vehicle incentives, and you know, maybe even more so with natural gas. Georgia has had has been really successful in their tax credits for electric vehicles. They now have some that apply to natural gas vehicles as well. And then for natural gas vehicles, we also see states looking at different loan programs, and these normally focus on developing the fueling infrastructure, and these types of incentives are really, we see them very specifically to natural gas vehicles. And I put in a couple examples, but you can see the costs really range, but oftentimes we see loans, zero interest loans or low interest loans of up to $1 million for businesses to install fueling infrastructure. What seems to be most popular when it comes to natural gas vehicles is, again, looking at fleet acquisition. So many states now require a certain percentage of the state fleets to be alternative fuel vehicles, and quite a few states specifically mention natural gas vehicles. On this map, I also included any states that maybe don't have a mandate but have a goal of converting vehicles to natural gas or alternative fuels. So you can see there's more states on here than states that I would consider actually have an incentive in place. So we go from states who have maybe a purchasing natural gas vehicles where it makes sense to Rhode Island that now has a requirement that at least 75% of state vehicle acquisitions are alternative fuel vehicles. I also wanted to quickly talk about one of the bigger coordinated state efforts that we've seen. In 2011, Governor John Hickenlooper of Colorado announced this memorandum of understanding with Oklahoma's Governor Mary Fallon. And the purpose of this MOU was basically to reach out to the automakers and see if states pooled their resources, if they could convince the automakers not only to offer more natural gas vehicle options, but also offer them at a lower price. And so since that time, about 20 states have joined this MOU, and they found great benefits of joining together. Four different automakers came back with proposals, and it's brought down state fleet costs by joining together. And part of that MOU, which helped reassure the automakers, is that the states agreed to purchase a specific number of natural gas vehicles, so they knew that the sales would be there. And lastly, the last of the state maps, I just wanted to point out that natural gas vehicles also have a lot of different tax exemptions. We don't really see any similarity among states on what those tax exemptions are, but they may be a tax exemption on the sales and use tax or an excise tax or even a fuel tax in certain instances. And so this is very specific to natural gas vehicles, but seems to be pretty popular among states. So just kind of wrapping up what NCSL sees as the different incentives, you know, we see there's a lot of different incentive options out there, and the states that so far seem the most successful in having natural gas vehicle adoption, whether it's, you know, in the medium to heavy duty sectors, are the states that offer a variety of incentives that not only look at vehicle procurements, but also look specifically at incentives for fleets and the fueling infrastructure together. So there are, for those lobbying for natural gas vehicles, there's a few areas at the federal level that are currently of concern. One is in 2005, two laws passed, the Energy Policy Act of 2005, and another bill with a much longer title that offered tax credits for natural gas vehicles. So the Energy Policy Act offered an income tax credit, and the other bill offered a 50-cent tax credit for CNG and LNG. Those both expired in 2013, and although Congress has considered extending those tax credits, currently they're expired. And so at a time when we're trying to increase natural gas vehicle adoption, this is seen as a disincentive provided by the federal government. There's also one of the biggest towards LNG is this LNG tax inequity. And basically, LNG and diesel are both taxed at the same rate, but it takes about 1.7 gallons of LNG to produce the same amount of energy that a gallon of diesel produces. So effectively, LNG is taxed at a 70% higher rate than diesel. Gasoline and compressed natural gas, on the other hand, are taxed according to their energy output. So it's really LNG seems to be the only alternative fuel that seems to be unfairly taxed. There have been a few proposed measures in Congress that would tax fuels on an energy content basis rather than on the volume basis, but so far those have been referred to committees and we haven't seen any action. The other potential issue of concern is this excise tax on heavy trucks. So currently there is a federal law that imposes a 12% tax on heavy trucks, but because natural gas trucks cost more than their comparable diesel trucks, the tax rate is much higher on natural gas vehicles and could be an incentive for fleets to switch over.
This might be a good time for me to note that I plan for us to take a 10-minute break after the next presenter so that people can take the time to make a phone call or go get coffee or use the restroom. So that would be after the next presenter. I know the Republican senators have been taken care of, but the rest of us might have to walk down to the cafeteria.
They're not looking out for us, are they? Still at divide.
Ms. Hartman.
Blew up.
So the last issue of potential federal concern is, as I said, natural gas vehicles, due to the tanks and natural gas, weigh more than their diesel counterparts. So there's a concern that if, you know, these heavy-duty trucks switch over to natural gas, they can carry less freight due to the federal highway limits. So a few states have try to get around this by passing weight limit exemptions in an effort not to penalize natural gas vehicles. Indiana, Ohio, and Virginia now have a 2,000-pound exemption. Colorado has a 1,000-pound exemption. However, you know, this isn't a federal law, so these trucks still can't have the heavier weight on interstates.
Madam Chair.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hartman, two questions about this, about the natural gas, one of which is comparison of greenhouse gas. I know we have a presentation on other air quality issues, but greenhouse gas between natural gas and other fuels. And number two, UPS, I know they do a lot of long-haul fleet. How much of the natural gas fleet stuff is interstate long-distance stuff, and how much would be like local? Like if you use that company, or we got Randy's Sanitation and others here, how much of it is local use for local fleets and how much is long-haul fleets, do you know?
Ms. Hartman.
Thank you. I'm not sure what the percentages are, but I would say just from my research, it varies. I mean, there's both long-haul and, I mean, so far what we've seen is a lot of fleets using CNG, and that would be a smaller area. But we're seeing this kind of bigger push towards the long-haul LNG trucking. So greenhouse gas emissions, maybe the methane leakage. At this point, there are studies currently underway. At this point, the studies vary so much in the amount of, in this case, methane leakage from natural gas, that it's hard to say exactly what those emissions are. I mean, I think we'll have more concrete numbers hopefully soon at the EPA. This is something that they're looking at. You know, they've come out with their study. There's also a whole bunch of different academics and environmental groups that are looking into methane, but at this point it's still unclear exactly how those methane emissions impact the natural gas vehicle sector. And then just quickly, I wanted to touch on hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicles. This is an area that we're starting to see states look at as, you know, another alternative fuel. So primarily state incentives have focused on electric vehicles. Now we're seeing this growth in natural gas vehicles. And then we're just starting to see interest among states related to hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. So quickly, the benefits of hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicles. It's another way to diversify our transportation fuels. Hydrogen fuel cells are also zero emission vehicles. They have a comparable driving range to a conventional engine, so 300 to 400 miles. And refueling is also similar to that of what you would fill up your current gas tank. I think, you know, it takes less than 10 minutes to refuel a hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicle. And then we've seen, you know, electric vehicles, especially in this kind of light duty passenger vehicles, and we've seen natural gas looking more in the medium to heavy duty. One of the supposed benefits of hydrogen fuel cells is that they can be scaled to any of those.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a quick question in regards to the diversified transportation fuels. Aren't we still dealing with some of the issues of infrastructure issues? As we have more and more fuels options, we have a distribution issue and availability issue too. Now, are there any ideas on how we can mainstream that without creating an economic impact as well?
Ms. Hartman.
I think, you know, at this point you're correct. There's kind of different studies looking at focusing on regional aspects, and so that you're kind of pulling resources and taking them less of a distance. Follow up?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I think, Madam Chair. I think that is one of the concerns that we have as we push for incentives and everything for vehicles and different types of fuels. We have to also look at what the infrastructure needs are as well and how you incentivize those as well. And so I was just curious if there was any thought on how we could handle that in a, I guess, most bang for the buck process. So thank you.
Hartman. Senator Tomasoni.
This is interesting because I remember when we were in Germany and saw the hydrogen fuel cars that seemed to be exactly the same as the gasoline-powered cars and would be a tremendous way to clean up our air if we could get all of our cars fueled by hydrogen. But and you're right, the infrastructure problem is huge here. But the natural gas technology has been around for a really, really long time, and it just, I mean, I remember when, in my other life, when I was over in Italy for a little while, and they would have these natural gas tanks on top of their little cars, but they couldn't use them in the cold winter because it didn't work very well. Is that still a problem, or have they gotten past that, you know, about the cold weather issue? Or?
Thank you. I think, you know, from what I've read and heard so far, that isn't, there may be some energy loss in colder temperatures, but for the most part, the technology is advanced enough that the cold weather conditions aren't going to make such an impact to the vehicle sector.
Well, does it start though in the cold weather? That's the question.
I have not heard any complaints. I know that there's going to be another speaker on natural gas vehicles that might know more about the technology. So looking back at hydrogen, you know, there are a few challenges. The biggest being the lack of infrastructure and that there are also just few vehicles on the road. And I will talk about in just a second just some of the upfront costs of hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicles. So what we're seeing with hydrogen, which is we haven't seen it as much with other alternative fuels, is this kind of public-private partnership starting really from the beginning and looking at bringing together a whole host of different organizations. So through the Department of Energy and some of the Department of Energy labs, as well as hydrogen producers and the automakers, all coming together from the beginning to look at how to promote hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. And the purpose of this public-private partnership is to really focus on building out this infrastructure so that as vehicles become available in the U.S., it will entice consumers to purchase them. So we've seen quite a bit of state action on hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. At least 24 states currently have some type of incentive. Most common, though, are states going back to their current incentive packages and adding in hydrogen as an alternative fuel. That's allowing hydrogen to become a part of many of the current incentives that are already in place versus passing additional incentives specifically to hydrogen fuel cells. There are a few other examples, though. Iowa does have a $2,000 tax deduction specifically to hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. And then we've talked about this with electric vehicles, but last year we saw eight states come together, so the West Coast and northeastern states, looking at putting 3.3 million vehicles on the road by 2025. This is a pretty aggressive goal. They've just come out with their action plan, and it really focuses on, again, hydrogen and electric vehicles, looking at the vehicles in particular and the infrastructure. And similar to what we saw with the MOU with natural gas vehicles, this is the hope is that by working together, hydrogen fuel cells can move along faster into vehicle adoption. So really all we have right now is a pilot program in California, the California Fuel Cell Partnership. Although these hydrogen technologies have been around for a while and California has been looking at incorporating them into the state, it wasn't until last year they passed a bill that provides specific funding to a hydrogen fuel cell network. And one of the biggest things in this roadmap to hydrogen fuel cells that California has discussed is going back and forth of whether or not we need the stations before the vehicles, or do we need the vehicles available before the stations. What they've kind of come out with is that we need both sort of at the same time, but California as a state is focusing on getting the infrastructure in place and working with the automakers to make sure as soon as these stations come online that there's also vehicles available. So the goal is about 51 stations by 2016, and within that, you know, California's done different surveys, and hopefully anyone that buys a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle will only have to drive about 6 minutes to reach a fueling station. That's their goal. So these are the vehicles that California will see now and into 2015. The first one is the Hyundai, which is available now in California. There's also Toyota and Honda will be launching their versions. They're pretty sporty looking cars. I know it's been reported that the Toyota vehicle will be on the market for around, I think, $67,000. So it's a pretty expensive vehicle, and that's one of the reasons, you know, California has a pretty robust set of incentives to hopefully drive down some of that vehicle cost. So just to wrap up, we still see, you know, unlike electric vehicles in the light duty sector, we, you know, see minimal growth with natural gas vehicles, see potential with hydrogen fuel cells. You know, this interest is growing and kind of building up these sectors. There's all different types of incentives available, and we based on our experience with electric vehicles, it seems like the comprehensive package of different incentives is what drives consumers to purchase these vehicles. And as we're looking at these newer alternative fuel technologies, it's the focus on the infrastructure and the vehicle availability together. Here's my contact information. NCSL has quite a few resources on alternative fuel vehicles. We also have a database that tracks all legislation related to alternative fuels. So if you were looking for specific bill language from a state, you can go to the database and it'll be available. Thank you.
Thank you. I also wanted to thank you for traveling from Denver both last time and this time to provide us with this information. Senator Rosen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hartman, I was kind of half joking with Senator Sinjum, but do you know where these vehicles are made? Are they made in the U.S. or are they made overseas?
For hydrogen?
Mm-hmm.
I know the Toyota vehicle, I believe it's made in Japan. I know there's someone who may know later today if that's correct. I know at least it came out in Japan first. I'm not sure if they're made in the U.S. So.
Senator Rosen.
It'd be interesting to know.
Senator Sinjum.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have just maybe a question. I have a fairly substantial company in Dodge Center, Minnesota, that makes an awfully lot of garbage trucks and cement trucks, and nearly, I better be careful, but I know a whole lot of those, before they leave Dodge Center, go over across the street and get retrofitted into natural gas. And so it seems to be, at least in that sector, to be really emerging. But I also have another question. We have not talked at all about, and we just came off a harvest season here, or maybe finishing up, but, you know, the large agricultural equipment, the tractors, the combines, and so on and so forth, is natural gas a competitive fuel for that sector at all? Is it being considered, or has it been thought of, or is it just totally not applicable or appropriate?
Ms. Hartman.
Thank you. Well, first, you know, we've seen huge growth kind of in the waste management trucks. That's, you know, one of the biggest areas where we've seen natural gas vehicles being converted, and it seems to be working really well. As far as tractors, you know, I believe that there are options to convert over to natural gas vehicles, but I'm basing that more on the types of incentives I see. So there might be someone later who can talk more specifically about that. Otherwise, I can look it up for you and get back to you.
Senator Sinjum, follow up?
Well, and maybe just another comment. Back in Rochester, for instance, MnDOT just finished a major new garage facility down there for snowplows and so on. And I think, unfortunately, and this may be something we talk about in bonding committees going forward, but we ought to be outfitting these large garages for fueling with natural gas. I just, you know, if a vehicle leaves a place and comes back at the place at the end of the day, then that is probably a pretty good application for natural gas vehicles, snowplows in particular.
Senator Sinjum, you're setting up the second half of the agenda very well, because there are some Minnesota companies who are going to describe to us the process of using this technology for their fleets.
Okay.
So thank you for the question. Any other questions for Ms. Hartman? I want to note that she has provided a lot of information that's in members' packets. It will be online on the committee site. So she didn't cover everything, but she gave us a lot of information on other topics as well. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Our next presenter and our last presenter before the break is John Hunter from the American Lung Association. Thank you so much for being here this morning.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to be a part of this as well. And I love standing between people and bricks. So. I hope to do kind of a quick transition from Ms. Hartman's presentation to the folks you'll be hearing later, some of the actual users and that kind of stuff. But I also want to emphasize kind of why we're here and why we want to talk about this and why alternative fuels are particularly important in Minnesota. So for that reason, I'll be talking a little bit about air quality in Minnesota and why it needs to improve and why alternative fuel vehicles are an important part of that. and some of what we've been doing to help with the natural gas vehicle transitions in Minnesota. I will also mention, in addition to working with the American Lung Association, we also staff the Twin Cities Clean Cities Coalition, which, despite its name, does work statewide on reducing petroleum use. The Clean Cities Program is a Department of Energy program that has 100 coalitions around the country. That really, it provides a good framework for enabling local actions on alternative fuels that kind of best fit the markets. So a lot of our experience has been biofuels in the past, which I'll talk about a little bit. But now we've been getting more into the electric vehicles and natural gas vehicles as well as those markets have kind of come to Minnesota. So nationwide, the Clean Cities Program has been around about 21 years and has reduced petroleum about 3 billion gallons through the different stakeholders that are participating in it. So part of the reason the only reason really we got into alternative fuel vehicles is Minnesota's air quality and the effect that has on lung health. Our air is not as healthy as it needs to be in Minnesota. Many of you may have heard that the U.S. EPA is scheduled by December 1st to determine whether or not they will be lowering the allowed ozone levels under the Federal Clean Air Act. The current standard is 75 parts per billion. Their scientific advisory committees have recommended to the EPA that a level of 60 to 70 parts per billion is more appropriate for protecting human health. And as you can see with the chart, many Minnesota communities fall into that level. We're still below 70 parts per billion, so if it were set there, we would remain in the good graces, I guess you would say, of the EPA. But 12 of the 15 communities that are shown on these air monitoring equipment are in a level between 60 and 68 parts per billion. So which not only for the, I guess, federal regulatory side is important, but to me indicates that our air is not as healthy as we need to be. The American Lung Association is advocating for a 60 part per billion level, think out of recognition that would be the most protective of human health. So regardless, I guess, of where the standard gets set, we really do feel the air pollution limits need to come down in Minnesota to lower the number of hospitalizations and asthma attacks and other triggers that can occur due to ozone. Now, ozone.
Before you move on, can you explain some? What are the health effects for human beings related to ozone? Just a little bit.
The ozone is formed sort of on hot summer days, typically, and it needs sunlight and heat, but it's a chemical reaction between nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds, typically, as well as some other little things. But it's really the NOx and the VOCs react on the hot summer days. And exposure to that can vary, but it's often been likened to kind of a sunburn on the lungs. It can create irritation and inflammation. If you happen to have asthma or COPD, as more than half a million Minnesotans do, it could be all that much more detrimental in that it can trigger asthma attacks or it can further inflame already impacted folks. So typically the elderly with COPD or young folks whose lungs are still in development or Minnesota, young folks also breathe more air per sort of body weight than adults do. So they have greater incidence of impact from ozone as well.
Thank you.
And fine particulate is also a very similar situation in Minnesota where the Science Advisory Committee for the EPA has recommended a level that is below where Minnesota would be considered if we looked at the past few years of data. The EPA won't be ruling on a new set of particulate matter for a few years now, but again, it's indicative of the fact that our air is not as healthy as it needs to be, and it's putting Minnesotans in the hospitals, it's triggering asthma attacks, and it's having a number of other impacts. Exposure to fine particulates, it can cause similar health impacts as ozone, but it's also more highly associated with premature death as well as cancer risks. So breathing fine particulate matter, particularly diesel particulate matter, can be extremely detrimental to health. So the reason then that these kind of two come up in this situation, how this relates, is the fact that vehicle pollution in Minnesota is the largest single source of the secondary and the primary sources of particulate matter and ozone sources. So this chart is from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency in their air report last given to you. It indicated, you know, about 28% of our pollution issues are coming from on-road vehicles, and then when you add in off-road vehicles and other sources, you get close to half our emissions of some of these primary pollutants in Minnesota. I should have also mentioned, I guess not to your health point, but Madam Chair, fine particulates, they're about 1/30th the size of a human hair or so, so they can travel very deep down into the lungs. So in addition to lung health impacts where they can kind of get lodged in, some are small enough to pass through into the bloodstream, which is where a number of the cardiovascular issues and other problems associated with particulate matter comes from. So it's not just lung health issues, I guess you'd say. I should also mention that health impacts are disproportionately impacting communities of color and low-income communities, in part because of their proximity to major roadways. There really is sort of a zone around major roadways where this air pollution has its greatest health impacts, and those typically tend to be then the lower-income communities or communities of color in Minnesota. Many of you may have seen the Department of Health maps that came out earlier this summer, where they mapped out asthma attacks and hospitalizations, emergency room visits by zip code, and you can in the metro area, but you can sort of trace the major roadway corridors and in the areas of impact. One person from the Department of Health talking yesterday at a public forum, I think, said some of these zip codes have 5 to 6 times the level of asthma hospitalizations as other areas that are not near the major roadways. So that really leads to why we've been fighting for air and supporting alternative fuels in Minnesota for more than 15 years now. Our work really did start out in the biofuels world. We've been working on developing E85 infrastructure with partners such as Ford and GM and the Minnesota corn growers, and state agencies and federal agencies. And Minnesota has developed a nation-leading infrastructure for the retail sales of E85 and the availability. We have more than 250 locations around Minnesota. And it's, I think, a growing success. And the price of E85 is quite low right now compared to gasoline, and a number of new stations are coming on to the market, continue to come on the market. So it continues to grow right now. Similarly, Minnesota's biodiesel use sort of leads the nation, with us this year developing a 10% summer blend and a 5% winter use. We're estimated to reduce 671,000 tons of greenhouse gas emissions each year with our biodiesel use. So it's, I think, a great example of that it can work, and even in a cold state, we can figure out how to make these alternative fuels work. And as mentioned, the LEC heard earlier this year on electric vehicles, those are growing in use in Minnesota, and the infrastructure is developing out. A lot of that, I think, due in part to the Drive Electric Minnesota, which is a coalition of working groups, some of which you heard from this during the session this last winter. And we've used that model to kind of work on the natural gas vehicles as well. And so I'll talk about that in just a little bit. As mentioned in Ms. Hartman's presentation, there are a good number of air benefits to using natural gas at the tailpipe. It reduces hydrocarbons, carbon monoxide, NOx, and greenhouse gases. On sort of the magnitude of 20% to 40% less carbon monoxide, up to 80% less particulate matter, and 30% to 40% less greenhouse gases, depending on what kind of engine types you're comparing and those kinds of things. Sort of different size engines have different levels of benefit. And that, of course, all means fewer roadside emissions and good benefits for people who are breathing the air. As mentioned, we took the Drive Electric Minnesota model and some funding from the Department of Energy and looked to see how we could expand that kind of thing towards the natural gas world. And we've been working with a large number of partners in Minnesota for a couple of years now to try to build out this infrastructure and develop the resources that fleets might need to really look into how to expand this fuel. So there are more than 80 different individuals involved. This is just a little example of the kind of folks that are involved, some of whom you'll hear from later. It kind of spans a good range of fleets and other things. They're really kind of working together to develop case studies, develop resources for other fleets, hosting workshops and ride and drive events and trainings for first responder emergency trainers and that kind of stuff. So that we're all prepared for a better market in Minnesota. As mentioned, there were approximately 470 refueling sites around the country. In Minnesota, we have a smaller number, it's safe to say. But we have 14 that are currently open to the public or will be very soon, including one that was going to have a celebration in Fairmont today. But they, for some reason, decided being outside today was not the ideal way to party. And but it is now open to the public for refueling. And we will have a couple more coming up down south in the next few weeks, bringing our total to 14. There are also we have five private sites show our towns referenced here, but they're actually, I think, more than that, given a number of fleets have their own private sites. But some of these sites are kind of nice and friendly in that if you happen to be driving a CNG vehicle and needing a refuel, they will kind of let you stop by. And so it's sort of a secondary infrastructure, if you will, to, that can be available if you know the right people, I guess. I will also point out, nationally, the price of CNG is, I think, about $2.17. It was last month. In Minnesota, it's actually typically sold about $1.99 for a gallon of gas equivalent. So it's that's where the economics kind of helped us start to build up. And it's really I think some of the earlier points, the heavy-duty uses tend to be where the economics really are kind of paying off the most right now. If you're comparing $4 or $4.25 a gallon for diesel versus $2 for a gallon of CNG, the economics really do start to pay off on the larger scale. The range does tend to be a little bit smaller, but I think a lot of the heavy-duty fleets, you know, they tend to return to a centralized location on a very regular basis, and that makes it easier to develop the infrastructure kind of necessary for fleets in certain positions to really do it. So we've actually talked to some fleets recently who are putting on 12 to 20,000 miles a month on some of their bigger trucks. So you can see if you're doing 20,000 miles of driving in a month, saving on fuels really does start to come into place. It has kind of been the sanitation world that has been quick adopters, and to your point, Senator DeSantis, earlier, there was a McNeilius truck, cement truck, picture in one of the earlier pictures. This is a McNeilius waste hauler here. Because I understand it, 40% or more of the trash trucks in 2011 were natural gas, and the new ones were being produced as natural gas. So their fuel usage in a year is much, much higher than on a consumer level. And so that has been, I think, part of the driving force for it. That said, I think that we know of 87 different types of natural gas vehicles you can get, ranging from sedans to heavy-duty street sweepers and long-haul trucks and other things like that. So there are a wide variety of vehicle types that are out there. There are more sedans, I think, on the way. I think there will be CNG versions of the Impala, and of the Chevy Cruze. If they're not already available on the market, they will be soon, I believe. And, of course, the Honda Civic has been around for a good number of years. But the heavier-duty uses have been the things, and the stronger part of the market. There are some built in Dodge Center at the McNeilius site at the cement factory. New Flyer in St. Cloud also builds a CNG bus, which are actually in use in St. Cloud in their bus system now. They use CNG buses built in St. Cloud. Then some of the other folks we've been seeing uses from include Quick Trip, and CHS has a few vehicles now, and they're the ones who opened up the facility in Fairmont just recently. And you'll hear from some of these other users later. But they do kind of span what you would typically expect from the medium to heavy duty kind of fleet markets. That's it for that. I know some of this is going to be more covered by folks who are following after the break as well, so I didn't want to get too in-depth, but I'd be happy to take any questions on that.
I have a quick question. I'm wondering if you're focusing some of your activities in the areas where the health impacts have been the greatest.
I can't say yes to that, I'm afraid. Our heaviest travel corridors do tend to be the interstates of 94 or 35. And I think the Department of Health maps that you see where the asthma hospitalizations are in the Twin Cities, that kind of thing, do tend to be in along those sort of central corridors, North Minneapolis and those kind of areas. Particularly in this kind of world, that does not tend to be where a lot of the fleet activity has been, I don't think. I think there's a lot of opportunity to kind of target that, but I think Mr. Williams will be shown in his presentation there's only one natural gas refueling site in Minnesota, or in Minneapolis, St. Paul right now. So the infrastructure is the public infrastructure is not quite there. That's not to say the right size fleet couldn't do that. And I think that's an important point, though, and needs to be done. I think that's in my world, I think different fuels work for different types of vehicles and that kind of stuff. A lot of the urban commuting can, I think, well be covered by electric vehicles as well as natural gas and other vehicles, but I think there's a lot of opportunity for that. But it's not been what's been happening so far. I think you do start to see that with some of the electric vehicle charging infrastructure. Part of the problem also then comes down to the fact that these vehicles do cost more. And any alternative fuel, I shouldn't say that, but with the electric natural gas world, these vehicles cost more. And so where new cars are being purchased do not typically also line up well with where some of the health impacts are greatest.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. When we talk about the health impacts, I mean, it's been well established that the rates of asthma and bronchitis and all those things come from air pollution. But what's new and we haven't talked about today is that we all know that the incidence of ADHD have just skyrocketed. Well, now Columbia University has put out a study saying that you have 9 times more ADHD in areas of high air pollution. So if a pregnant pregnant woman has a little kid and you test the little kid at 9 years old, if there's heavy air pollution, they're going to have ADHD at 9 times the rate. There was the lead story in the Strib yesterday was about that, and perhaps it would be good if you would get that story out and send it around to folks. So we have now a huge new way that we've got to think about these things. It's not just grown-ups and kids getting asthma. And I think you've correctly pointed out that there's even heavier impact in urban areas. So just to talk about a little bit changes in fleets is like not even nibbling at the cookie. I think we've got to have some more serious conversations about what we do here. Natural gas is not the solution for this problem.
Yeah. Mr. Hunter.
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, thank you for pointing that out, too. The article yesterday really did highlight a particular pollutant known as polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs, which again is another byproduct of combusting fuels. The largest source, according to the I think the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency provided on everyone at the legislature. I'm sure you've read their biannual air emissions report. And so from the 2013 report, they have a chart of the different sources of different types of air pollutant based on kind of the leading sources. And so PAH is mentioned in particular. And so 38% of the sources in Minnesota are coming from light-duty vehicles. And another 19%, 15% from heavy-duty vehicles. So it's definitely a realm where our vehicle traffic is it's another demonstration of the health impacts. And to your point, it's not enough to keep this at a fleet scale for sure. I think, as Ms. Hartman mentioned, the certain economies of scale kind of start to come into factors of bringing down vehicle prices and that kind of stuff. I believe part of the reason the Department of Energy's Clean Cities program has focused on fleets, one is their sort of disproportionate large use of fuel, but two is to start to generate that market so that the refueling infrastructure and those kind of things can be start to be developed to better incentivize the adoption of the technology into a broader and broader audiences. It kind of goes back to a little bit to the chicken and egg notion of if you develop the refueling infrastructure before the vehicles or the vehicles before the infrastructure.
Follow-up, Representative Wiginius.
Well, that brings me, I'm just sitting here struggling with this natural gas and our then putting forth incentives, as you suggest. I can get why Texas does that, or maybe Pennsylvania, because they have the natural gas. We are not a natural gas producer.
Right.
So we had earlier testimony from the Department of Employment and Economic Development that we are now exporting $18 billion of Minnesota dollars, and that's a damper on our economy. So why I'm having trouble getting why we are still talking about fuels that where we have to purchase them from other states instead of talking about fuels we develop internally. I'm struggling with that. Is anybody else struggling with that?
Yeah. Representative Wiginius, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head in terms of the conversation that this information was intended to provoke. I think you can tell from the agenda there's not conclusory information about whether Minnesota should or should not incentivize natural gas vehicles or other alternative vehicles, but the idea being that the members of the commission should be educated on kind of the pros and cons, what's happening in other states as we go into another legislative session to think about whether this is a road we want to go down, or if somebody else chooses to go down this road, what the topics of conversation might be. So I think the information that we're presenting here today is not with a perspective of Minnesota should do X, Y, or Z, but just to put information in front of the members of the commission so we can be better educated as these topics come up or don't come up during the session.
All right. I feel a little bit better now because I'm feeling a push to do natural gas and create an infrastructure. And I'm thinking, is that where we want to spend our dollars? I mean, we have limited dollars. Why would we be doing this? So thank you.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hunter, I have my new glasses on, and I still can't read some of this really, really small writing on this one chart. And so on the your two charts, the ozone and the fine particulate matter chart, if I understood the ozone chart correctly, the idea is to get those green bars up to the red line. Is below the red line on the fine particulate matter chart a good thing or a bad thing?
You want to be below the red lines.
In both charts?
For the fine particulate case, the orange line is where the Science Advisory Committee has recommended the levels be dropped down to. So being above that line would indicate that there are health concerns with our air quality.
And farther below that line, the better off you are.
Yes.
So, like, Virginia has wonderful air, is what we're saying.
In a particulate sense, it does seem to be doing pretty good on a three-year average.
Yeah, but just making sure.
Senator Tomasoni, how's the cross-country skiing up there? Great.
Particulates do tend to be a case where cold air does tend to help out. It's kind of those mild winters with inversions and things like that that can really be hardest on Minnesota's air quality for particulate matters. So you should be rooting for keeping it cold, I guess, up there.
Okay, members. We will take a brief recess. Senator Sinjam, you okay following up individually with Mr. Hunter? Or did you want to ask a question before we take a break?
Maybe just a follow-up to Representative Wagenius's question. I'm sitting here wondering, urban air in general across the country, whether it's Los Angeles or Twin Cities or whatever, and I'm old enough to remember things like smog indexes and so on and so forth. Catalytic converters and other things have come along. Cars have been improved, at least car engines. Generally speaking, is the air worse today than it was, say, in the 60s and the 70s, I mean, there's certainly more cars, I know that, but overall, if you were to look at data going back, 40 or 50 years versus today, do we have worse air in this country, and especially in urban areas? I mean, again, I don't hear about smog, whether it's Los Angeles or the Twin Cities or Chicago. That term seems to have gone away.
Mr. Hunter, if I can paraphrase Senator Sinjam's question, has the Clean Air Act worked in some regard?
Well, I see Representative Guineas wants to get in on this too. But, and Madam Chair, Senator Sinjam, yes, I think our air is cleaner in general. It was quite bad, and we are getting better. Part of the trick with ozone in particular, though, is that it does react with hotter summer days. So global warming actually has the potential to make our ozone issues more widespread, I think, going forward. As summer days get hotter, we have greater potential for some of these kind of chemical reactions occurring in the air. So it's quite possible that our air quality will be getting worse, even as some of these technologies reduce some of the other emissions, simply because the environment will be there to have some of these reactions occur. So we're not out of the woods, I guess that's to say. And I think Los Angeles is still struggling with their smog, truth be told.
Yeah, maybe so.
A number of them. But they do also have some unique geographic issues that kind of trap their pollution, whereas a lot of ours gets blown away more quickly.
So it would seem to me that we were producing as much or more ozone and 40 or 50 years ago of vehicles and other sources as we are today. But you're suggesting, I think, that this ozone thing is a growing phenomenon, or a growing issue, rather.
Madam Chair, Senator Sinjam, I also should have pointed out our air is better, but the science indicating at what level is unhealthy has also improved, to the point that level continues to go down. As mentioned, the ozone level of 75 parts per billion, that was set in 2008, because that's what the science at the time indicated. But now the science seems to indicate it should be 60 to 70 parts per billion. So I think both tend to be on a downward trajectory.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. Thank you.
Representative Wagenius, did you have a closing comment?
Just to note that in our committee this last year, the Pollution Control Agency gave us some numbers working with just lockdown science that the medical community has given us, that even at our current levels of air pollution, which are below the federal standards, our medical costs are astronomical. And so we can get those numbers from the Pollution Control Agency and share them with this committee. So even though we're below the federal standard, our costs, medical costs from air pollution are unbelievably high. It's just, it's from the bronchitis, the asthma, early deaths, a whole bunch of things, and now we add to it the ADHD. So it's just, I think we're just getting smarter, and the medical community is making us smarter.
All right. Everybody looks like they could benefit from standing up and walking around, being more awake for the second part of the hearing where we focus on Minnesota technology. So we will reconvene and start at 11:05. We're in recess. Okay, 10:05.
Oh.
It's a little hard for me to read the clock.
Horses.
My old age.
Yeah, there you go.
Terrible.
There you go.
How could I look at that? The 11:05.
Yeah.
Our audience looks like people like someone. Well, I mean, I think that we'll get more. Yeah, it would be interesting to have a jury. We'll just tell them what's going on.
It flows better. So.
If you just mentioned that you changed it around.
So where do you think we're going to end up?
What do you mean?
Time-wise?
I even did ask the chair if she wants to go long or just leave people up. Probably will go long. I apologize for that. Is that okay?
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. I have
you don't usually
a meeting with a student, but I can...
Oh, I'm really sorry about that.
No, that's fine. I can, my students are like...
What time is your meeting?
Oh, it's at 11:30, but I can switch. It's no problem.
Okay, I really apologize. Usually we stay on time. It's been getting worse and worse.
It's an exciting set of topics.
So,
it's in the LAC presentation folder here. David's in here, but I think he's coming. So.
Yes, and he gave me an updated one just this morning. Or last night around 11:30
yeah,
or something like that.
His training went well.
So I have all of the... they're all combined into one PowerPoint. So when your turn comes up, you just hit next.
Oh, I see.
So yeah, they're all together like this. Everyone's in order. It's just a lot easier than switching between different files.
Right. And so what happens is it just reads the next file in mine. And, right.
Yeah. I'm just gonna paste it in.
And David is after me?
He's after me.
No, I just talked to him on the phone, and I got the idea that he might go a little bit long.
You are very concerned.
All right.
It should be 10 minutes. I don't say I could attend maybe a little bit more, but.
Is that going to be loaded when I get up
there? It will be. Thank you for coming. So, this is where you'll sit. And as I was just saying, all the PowerPoints are combined into the same slide. So this slide will be up. This slide will be up before you go. So just hit next. And it'll take you right at the end. Even if you
okay. Right. Hit the down button.
Yep. The down button. Yeah.
All right.
Thank you very much. And I apologize, obviously, you can tell we're running.
Okay, thank you.
Well, when David gets here, if you just let him know that about the PowerPoint.
Yeah, no problem.
You're welcome.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
get them back on the start. Is the plan to do private and then come back here and then come back from here for the bus?
Yeah. Do you know who all is planning to take the bus?
I do not.
I do.
Oh.
Okay, do we have some staff that are going to?
Barb and
Good. Okay. Okay. Oh, great. Great. All right.
I get it.
Members, we're running a little bit behind schedule, so we're definitely going to get rolling again. I hope that the break helped people get circulation back into their bodies. You all looked as tired as I feel, so I can only assume I looked as tired as you feel. So we're going to start out with John Williams from CenterPoint Energy, and then we're going to move into the Minnesota companies who are using natural gas vehicles in their fleets. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Williams, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commission members. I appreciate the opportunity to present for you this morning, and Christy Hartman gave you a great overview from a national basis, and what I hope to do here in my presentation is give you an overview of what's going on in Minnesota, and then when some of the fleets owners that are actually using CNG and natural gas, they'll present later, and they'll fill that in even more. Just real quickly, over the last 4 years, I've spent that amount of time educating on basically using natural gas as a vehicle fuel. So to start, some of the reasons for the national momentum of natural gas vehicles is it really has started with the price of the competitive fuels. As I think everybody knows, the price of gasoline and diesel tends to jump up and down from about $3 a gallon to $4 a gallon or more. And we're at a little bit cheaper point right now, but that has been pretty consistent, at least for the last 4 years. Another thing that's been really important is the whole shale gas revolution, basically, and that's kind of, it's been referred to many times as the game changer. And basically why it's been a game changer is the new technology has allowed access to these vast shale deposits, providing a lot more natural gas, so it's kind of a supply-demand issue, and then it's pushed natural gas costs down, and that's why different fleets have sought to use that as a vehicle fuel. And there has been some increasing vehicle availability. Infrastructure is increasing. And there has been some pretty significant fleet adoptions by different corporations. Probably, I have a couple examples here on the slide, but probably the biggest one is AT&T. And it's been, I think theirs has been primarily light-duty vehicles, but it's been, they've got about 8,000 vehicles to date that are running on CNG. And then there also has been increasing availability of state incentives, and a lot of it has been because of the low cost. A lot of it has been, like what has been already mentioned, is in some of the producing states. And then another part has been obviously just the emissions advantages of natural gas over diesel and gasoline. Moving on real quickly, just the pricing here in Minnesota, and John Hunter kind of alluded to it, but basically the CNG pricing range that is currently in Minnesota ranges from about $1.89 to $2.14 a gasoline gallon equivalent. And compared to, now I picked these prices back on October 23rd, but I still think they're fairly representative, is gasoline at $3.19. The current range as of a couple of days ago is like $2.69 to $3.39, so it's in there. So CNG would be lower by about $1.05 or $1.30 a gallon, and then diesel prices our range right now from about $3.56 a gallon to $4.25 a gallon, and so you can see that natural gas would be about $1.50 a gallon cheaper. One of the really important things to notice or to understand about natural gas as far as pricing goes is it is much more stable in pricing It doesn't have the big jumps. And you can see here the range even isn't as big. The range is only about a quarter a gallon. Just a quick overview of NGVs in Minnesota. And John did a good job of identifying the different segments and also identifying where the different stations are. So I just want to make a couple different points here. And one is that I don't know if anybody has a accurate number, but we understand that there's about 300 to 400 NGVs in the state of Minnesota right now. And of the 12 to 14 public fast full stations, only four of those are within 25 miles of the Twin Cities. And those are in Eagan, St. Michael, Blaine, and Richfield. The Richfield one is also referred to Minneapolis, and that's actually CenterPoint Energy Station, basically at the intersection of 35W and Crossstone. And what's that isn't enough to really grow the use of CNG as a vehicle fuel, and I'll talk more about that in another slide. You really need a critical mass to get fleets to jump on. Some of the fleets you're going to hear about later today, I mean, those are ones that have just taken the jump, and they haven't waited for others, and they haven't waited for the infrastructure. And really, a couple of the key cogs to this, and again, Christy Hartman mentioned it, is a lot of the communities that are really progressive on natural gas is they'll have CNG filling at the airport, and they'll have it downtown, and then they kind of infill around the perimeter of the downtown. And of course, then they'll have like she showed you the highways and stuff. They'll have major corridors that they'll then try to get CNG refueling there, so that you can drive anywhere and not worry about what we call range anxiety, that you're going to run out of CNG. This slide is just to show some real quick examples, and again, they're only examples of some of the Minnesota NGV connections that we do have. And you can see that there's a pretty good variety there. It's makers of CNG tanks, there's makers of cryogenic LNG tanks, there's infrastructure builders, et cetera. So really, in kind of the early stages of NGV development, this was really a pretty good list, and like I say, this doesn't include everybody. And this will really help, corporate growth, expansion, and jobs. So some of the key NGV opportunities in Minnesota, really kind of, we refer to it as the sweet spots. Really the sweet spots are fleets that have high-mile vehicles, so they maybe run 100,000 miles a year or more, and then they're low miles per gallon. So in the case of like the heavy-duty vehicles, it could be, if they get 4.5 to 5 miles a gallon, well, obviously they're going to benefit from the lower cost per gallon, and also these vehicles tend to be the ones that are going to provide a lot of the pollution items that John did a good job describing. And one of the things just to notice here is that transit in Los Angeles, as an example, has over 200,000 buses, and St. Cloud, Minnesota, the Metro Bus up there, they just acquired 29 CNG buses this year. So that's only about 50 miles or so from us. And again, like John had mentioned, the emphasis is really on the commercial heavy-duty fleets because they can get the biggest bang for the buck. So I mentioned that there was national momentum, but there was also some challenges for natural gas as a transportation fuel in Minnesota. And you've heard some of that already. And really, the biggest one is lack of sufficient CNG fueling infrastructure. And we've kind of talked about that already, that in a lot of these alternative fuels, that seems to be the issue that everybody's trying to work on, is that really just having that refueling infrastructure. And what that does is, in the second bullet point here, where we talk about fleet hesitation to convert to CNG, it's a huge deal, because if they don't have stations nearby, or if they don't build their own, it's going to affect productivity. And actually, CenterPoint is experiencing this same thing as we're adapting and adding NG vehicles ourselves, is even though we have our own station, if we're trying to add these vehicles throughout our whole operations in Minnesota, the other operation centers aren't necessarily close enough. So we get into this discussion about, well, do you go dedicated? Well, if you go dedicated, then you're going to have to base it near either our station or near somebody else that's already built public fueling somewhere. And we like that, because that's going to be, if you go dedicated, you're going to get the biggest bang for the buck from the standpoint of economic savings, because that's all they're going to burn. If you go buy fuel, you know, how do you enforce or how do you regulate the users that, especially like within our group, that they're going to go and burn only CNG? If they're somewhere where they're fearful of running out of CNG, they're going to have to go and get gasoline if they're in a biofuel vehicle. So those are just some of the things that fleets face. Incremental vehicle costs is another one. Another issue is potential changes to maintenance facilities. And the other thing that was already pointed out is it's a new fuel, and it's different from the standpoint of it fuels just a little different. Once you've done it once, it's like it's not a big deal, but it's just all that uncertainty and change when you haven't done it before. So potential ways to jumpstart NGVs in Minnesota is, you know, fleets can take advantage of any available grant funding. And it's my understanding that the Metro Bus in St. Cloud, they took advantage of a grant through the Minnesota Department of Transportation Office of Transit Application Process. And so that was able to help them buy those buses. And, of course, we've already kind of covered, you know, you can provide additional funding to construct public access fast fuel, CNG stations, tax credits has been mentioned, and Christy mentioned all kinds of different opportunities or ways of doing it that have been utilized throughout the country. I guess the biggest thing is we really need to be flexible and creative, because there's no perfect way of doing this. Anything can work, so it could be a public-private partnership or some kind of collaboration of any means. And I guess last but not least, all alternative fuels play a role. And I don't want to sit here and say it's only natural gas, because it's not. You know, electric has a part, natural gas has a part, hydrogen vehicles have a part. So, you know, so it's important that all these different fuels, alternative fuels, have a piece of the puzzle, and that there's a level playing field, so that all of these fuels can help us reduce our you know, energy costs and help us reduce the emissions that John had just talked about. So in summary, and to close my presentation, some of the NGV benefits to Minnesota is really cleaner air. You know, it's gonna help with non-attainment, help us avoid that. It's gonna provide a less expensive vehicle fuel. It's gonna continue to positively impact Minnesota's economy. It'll help us maintain energy independence, and it can really help demonstrate Minnesota as a leader in using alternative fuels.
That's all I have. Thank you very much. Thank you for staying in your allotted time. Any questions from members? I'm sure you're willing to serve as a resource if we contact you after.
Absolutely. I'll provide my contact information. I realize I'll provide that to Annie.
That sounds great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And now the Minnesota companies who are using natural gas. We have a representative from Quick Trip, somebody from Randy's Environmental Services, and then Zero Res. And I don't know if you all three want to come up together or if Quick Trip want to come up first. Welcome to the committee. If you can pronounce your full name, that'd be helpful.
Yes, Madam Chair. Jeff Reichling with Quick Trip.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So for those of you that aren't aware, Quick Trip is a privately owned convenience store chain based out of La Crosse, Wisconsin. We do operate 437 convenience stores as of today. 119 of those stores are located in Minnesota, with three more to come by the calendar end. We employ 13,000-plus coworkers. But along with that, on the next page of this handout that you received, you'll see that we do operate our own fleet as well. That is called CT, or Convenience Transportation. Within CT, we have 395 vehicles, 157 of those being Class 6, 7, and 8 vehicles, which will be the primary focus of my discussion today. Overall, natural gas represents 26% of our fleet, but you can see on that heavy-duty side, it represents over 45% of our vehicles. In 2010, 11, and 12, As we were implementing our natural gas initiative, we really looked at all alternative fuels and what was going to be the best fit for our company. And that's how it truly started out. It wasn't meant to be a consumer fuel at the time. It was meant to be what was going to service our fleet. And from a light-duty sedan that was up and coming and is still being developed, all the way to our Class 8 80,000-pound GVW vehicles, natural gas was the best fit for those economically and otherwise. We implemented our first stations and ordered our first vehicles in 2012, so we are a few years into this. As of today, we operate 30 total natural gas stations, including one LNG facility. The rest are compressed natural gas. As you can see on the front page there, six of those locations are in Minnesota. We have one additional station in Austin, Minnesota that will open in a number of weeks. And at this point, we are in the process of planning next year's, and we will have two additional facilities in Minnesota with possibly more to come. We do have, obviously, more of those stations in the Wisconsin market, both because of increased vehicle growth there as well as our infrastructure being greater and our presence being more there. But when we got into this, as I stated, that natural gas was the best fit for us, we looked at it with three different avenues, and that was that it was a domestic fuel. It is produced in the United States. Those are American jobs. The second, that it was a cost savings to us, as you can see on a page here, that on our heavy-duty units, we're saving upwards of 22 cents per mile. And for those of you familiar with the trucking industry, most companies would do anything to save 1 cent per mile with the number of miles they run. But we also have implemented into our service vehicles. We're a little bit unique in the sense that we build our own stations. We have our own store engineering department. We transport our own products and goods. So that allows us to control all of that, as well as doing the maintenance on our facilities and vehicles. So literally every aspect of our business is being transitioned towards this alternative fuel. The goal by the end of 2016 will be to have 100% of our heavy-duty units be natural gas-powered, be it LNG or CNG. When we got into this, we put in an LNG facility in La Crosse because at that point it was unclear which fuel was going to be the front runner in this area of the United States. It's become very clear to us that compressed natural gas will be that fuel. LNG certainly has its place, especially in the larger uses like cargo ships, things like that. But for vehicles as we use them and with the technology improvements they've made with CNG tanks since then, compressed natural gas is very real and is very capable of doing the job. You can see on the next page there the life-to-date performance. This will only go up exponentially as we add more units as recently as we have. You can see that we've displaced over 1 million gallons of diesel up to this point. Next year, we anticipate that we'll run 11.5 million miles on natural gas between Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa highways. A few things that I wanted to touch on that have previously been mentioned are the maintenance facilities. What we found, you know, when this initiative started on the West Coast was that they put a lot of money into upgrading their maintenance facilities to be able to service natural gas vehicles, and a lot of it wasn't necessarily didn't need to be as costly as they made it. It at this point there is not a set regulation necessarily, so it's all up to the local fire marshal on maintenance facilities. So it truly depends on his knowledge and comfort level with natural gas as a vehicle fuel on what your requirements are going to be for a maintenance facility. The weight exemption was also mentioned. I think this would be a fantastic thing to see go through, not only on a state level, but obviously on a federal level as well, because, again, you shouldn't be allowed to carry less cargo or, in that sense, make less money because you're using an alternative fuel. It's somewhat of a penalty in our eyes, being that we're a bulk hauler as well. So that would certainly be important. What we're seeing, you know, is... Yes.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In regards to maintenance, because you are obviously do a lot of your own work, et cetera, and I know that each fuels tend to have their own nuances in regards to maintenance and development. Are you seeing any difference in maintenance upkeep with those running CNG versus LNG versus traditional fuels?
Mm-hmm. part of the reason that we see CNG as a better alternative, and you could see it in that cost per mile, but is that LNG is extremely expensive to maintain and fix if anything should go wrong. Because it's a cryogenic fuel, those parts are extremely expensive, as well as the transportation of getting the fuel to the source. On the CNG side, we truly believe, and what we've seen thus far a few years in, is that those vehicles are going to be a cost-neutral maintenance cost versus diesels.
Thank you.
Yes. There was also talk about whether or not this is an over-the-road or more of a regional fuel. Obviously, regional is where it works better now because of the infrastructure nationwide. But what we're seeing with a lot of over-the-road companies because of the driver shortage right now in the industry is that they're going to a more hub-and-spoke type operation where their drivers are home every night. They're running dedicated routes to stay within their hours of service and everything else. So that is allowing for much more natural gas usage as well. And to be more strategic about that. The other thing that was mentioned was winter experience. I think, knock on wood, we'd be hard-pressed to find a more difficult winter than last year to test these units. They performed extremely well, and I would argue that they were better for us than our diesel units. The fuel does not have the capability to gel. The biggest problem that we had is that we had to idle the vehicles for a few minutes, which we don't do with our diesels, but that was the very simple fix that we had to get everything to operating temperature and ready to go. So from that sense, it's much better. The other side that we need to look at is that typically in this area of the world, in the winter, you start blending number one fuel with your number two diesel to make sure that you don't gel and don't have those winter issues, which causes more fuel usage and lower economy on these vehicles. Again, with natural gas, you don't see that. The other large application that we see this going into that was a little talked about earlier was agricultural and industrial applications. We do see LNG and CNG being used for industrial applications as it becomes more portable and available, whether it's trains, mining equipment, things like that. There was talk of John Deere developing a natural gas engine, and I think it's kind of been put on hold. It hasn't been talked about a lot lately. The biggest issue that we see with that is the transportation cost of these fuels and the containers necessary to haul them to get them to those locations. It's much better suited when they can obviously visit a public or privately built infrastructure. So.
Thank you. Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Reckling, you mentioned something about the weight restrictions and that it would be better coming in instead of separate state regulations. Do you know anything if the feds are coming down with a comprehensive plan on that?
It's been talked about, but I think it was put on hold with everything going on recently, and I don't know the status of it currently, but I know it has not been passed.
Yeah, it makes your life more difficult. Yeah.
Senator Sundjum.
Just to follow up on that last one on agriculture, could conceivably a farmer have a large compressed natural gas tank on wheels that would be filled by a bulk truck and which would be, you know, portable out in the fields and so on and so forth? Is that conceivable?
It's very possible, and it's possible already. The issue with it is simply the cost. For these semis that you're looking at, the Class 8 vehicles, for us, for instance, it's between $30,000 and $35,000 more to put those tanks on than an equivalent diesel vehicle. Now, with our cost savings, we pay that back within a year. On the flip side, I've had customers that put on 170 gallons and spent $70,000 or $80,000. So the true issue is just in the cost of the cylinders.
Thank you. We appreciate your presentation. I wish we had more time, but I want to keep moving. Thank you so much. And don't be surprised if we contact you later with more questions we think of.
Thank you very much.
Our next presenter will be Jim Wolschlager from Randy's Environmental Services.
Yeah.
Thank you for being here today, and thanks for being here right at 8 o'clock.
Good morning, Madam
Even though
Chair.
Our members weren't.
Thank you. I'm going to speak a little bit today about our project for our anaerobic digester and how that ties back into our CNG truck use. Randy Sanitation is a company that was founded by Randy and Sandy Raskowiak in 1979, and we've been operating a sanitation and recycling company ever since. We're either the largest or one of the largest independent sanitation companies in Minnesota. We were the first ones to bring a natural gas fleet to Minnesota for sanitation company. We were in, our station was opened in late October of 2011. We opened with 7 trucks. We have fueling capacity for 80, and we're currently at about 37, and by the end of next year we should be at 50. So we formed Organic Solutions, and I'm the CEO of Organic Solutions and the COO of Randy Sanitation. We formed Organic Solutions a couple of years ago to house our Blue Bag Organics program, and we provide organic service, source separate organics, curbside service to our residential customers and our commercial customers. And when we introduced Blue Bag several years ago, we were buying those bags in British Columbia, and we've since purchased that manufacturing business and moved it to Maple Grove, Minnesota, and now manufacture blue bags and green bags and the other compostable mulch films and things that we manufacture in Maple Grove, Minnesota. So Organic Solutions is the owner and operator and designer around the Delano, Minnesota anaerobic digestion project. First of all, I want to say, when we talk about digestion and how that ends up as being natural gas, you wonder where that material comes from that you're digesting. And then that we're so involved in source-separated organics collection, I want to make it very clear that we believe in a sustainable source-separated organics recycling program. And the curbside program will provide local compost facilities a year-round stream of SSO that's not hampered by seasonal collection or DNR regulations. So a layered approach of organics collection is, we believe, by involving all stakeholders, we seek to benefit from a highest and best use scenario. So all clean, source-separated organics material that is collected by Randy Sanitation goes directly to the compost facilities and would not go into our digester project. The first layer of organics collection would be that curbside organics collection that's easily composted with yard waste. It has very little contamination. It creates it has a great gas value opportunity, and it currently represents 10 to 15% of the waste stream. Again, that material would go directly to composter. Layer two, if any of you had an opportunity to visit our facility a couple years ago when we were running our Dirty Murph, we ran our material through a 2-inch trommel, and that 2-inch trommel removed 25 to 30% of the MSW waste stream. Came out of that 2-inch trommel in a material that was very high in organics, and in fact it was over 57% organic matter. That material is easily composted with an added carbon source. It will meet a Class 1 compost standard, and the problem you have with that material is it has glass in it from the MSW stream. And while you can screen most of that glass out, you can't screen all of the glass out. So while it's still that material will meet a Class 1 compost standard, it's not suitable for bagged compost like the clean compost would. And that's why we feel it's so important that that curbside material go directly to the composter. In addition to pulling that 2-inch minus material off there, you're able to capture another 4 to 5% traditional recyclables. Layer three would be the project we're going to talk about today, and that represents 50 to 60% of the remaining MSW waste stream. That material again is easily digested in a dry fermentation digester with excellent gas value. It'll meet Class 1 compost standards as a digestate without an added carbon source. And again, the remaining small glass fraction prohibits retail sale as a bag material, but it is suitable for soil remediation projects or soil amendments. And again, the 4.12% additional recycling recovery is an opportunity. So our Organic Solutions Project, the future of waste management and energy recovery. This project is an innovative waste processing materials and energy recovery project that will reduce landfilling by 67%. The burst cell process will recover the waste organics and non-recycled paper fraction of the municipal solid waste stream, producing a processed engineered feedstock. The MRF will recover metals, plastics, and other recycled materials. The processed engineered feedstock will provide the primary feedstock for the state-of-the-art anaerobic digester and will produce a renewable natural gas with a zero carbon footprint. A soil amendment suitable for a variety of agricultural applications will be the digestate. The project will be located on a new site in the Delano Eco Park, adjacent to Randy's existing operation. Got a brief overview of how that project will lay out, and I won't get into that in any great detail. All right. There we go. The Smart Firm Dry Fermentation Technology, it is a 21-day process, proven digestion biology. It's a low temperature, 131 degree Fahrenheit, and pressure system of 0.16 to 0.24. All systems monitored and controlled by a PLC. The project metrics, 65,000 tons per year. It will be permitted for a two-phase system, so it will be permitted for 125,000 tons a year of MSW. All blue bag organics or SSO will go directly to local composters. None of this material will be used as a fuel for the digesters. The landfill diversion, 35 to 40,000 tons per year of processed organics, 4 to 6,000 tons of metals, plastics, and other recyclable material. The biogas produced will be 110 million cubic feet per year, yielding 70 million cubic feet of methane green natural gas. The fuel potential is 525,000 diesel gallon equivalents per year of CNG. Randy's Environmental Services has contracted to buy the CNG to fuel its fleet of 50 CNG trucks. So the fuel that's produced on site, the CNG that's produced on site, will be pumped over to our Delano facility right behind it, and we'll fill the 50 trucks that are housed there. In addition, we have a pay pump that's stubbed out there with fast fill tanks, and we'll activate that when that opens. We will produce 35,000 tons per year of finished compost. The CO2 recovery potential is 35 million cubic feet, or 2,000 tons. The construction of the project will generate 60 to 80 short-term jobs, and the operations will generate 12 to 15 long-term employment opportunities. The Smart Firm Anaerobic Digestion Odor Management System is a fully enclosed negative air pressure facility. Exhaust air is treated by biofilters. Carbon filters remove the H2S from biogas prior to biomethane upgrading. And the system is designed with two in-vessel composters to strip ammonia from digestate prior to outdoor composting. The acid scrubber pretreatments remove 90% of ammonia prior to final polishing into biofilter, and then close flare to burn biogas with low methane content at the end of the AD batch process. A couple of pictures, aerial pictures of the facility in San Jose that this one would be mirrored after. You can see the four large biofilters at the bottom of the screen in picture two, and you can see the two methane bladders on the roof. These are the systems that are currently under construction by Smart Firm, and you can see our system is set at the bottom there for construction in 2016. We're in the early stages of permitting right now. This gives an idea of gives you a list of the project team members and their responsibilities. And this is the project funding plan, project equity of $5 million, project debt of $27 million. We're hoping to get grants of $8 million for this project. Development and design are $2 million. MRF and burst cell process, $8 million. Smart Firm AD and CNG production of $21 million. Other project costs of $550 million. Property and site development, $1,250,000. Financing and working capital of $2,000. $2,050,000, and the project contingency of $3,350,000. And as these systems are fairly new technology, there is a necessary to have a little larger contingency built in. And then I can answer any questions you might have. It's a lot of information that I just figured out.
Thank you very much. That was fascinating. I think most members thought you were going to talk about trucks.
Well,
so that might be the bulk of the questions, but you've given us a lot to think about. Questions from members. Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wolschlager, how long did the permitting process go? How's that going, and how do you have any idea?
We're probably about 10% done in the permitting. We're just working with the MPCA now on air quality issues, and then we'll get into the deeper permitting dive.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. Any projections on the cost of the permitting? How much is that going to cost?
Mr. Welschlager.
Madam Chair, I would say the permitting is probably going to be about $40,000 worth of engineering costs for that.
Additional follow-up?
I just would like to follow that, the permitting piece of that.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, how much, you said you have 50 trucks that you'll be providing fuel for. How much of the fuel will be produced out of this project?
Mr. Welschlager.
Senator Marty, all of the fuel that we would burn in our trucks would be produced in this project. The first 525,000 gallons would go to fuel those trucks. The second stage of that, we would be looking for the fast fill and the public pay pumps to help burn up some of that gas. And as I said, the fueling station that we have now, the infrastructure, is set to fuel 80 trucks. So during the course of that time of upfitting, we would add the additional 30 trucks on site to fuel. So at that point, I believe now we probably even run the largest natural gas fleet of refuse trucks in Minnesota.
Other questions from members? Thank you so much. That was very fascinating. And I imagine we'll be talking more. The anaerobic digestion and compost is a hot topic at the Minnesota Legislature. So now we have Jim Hoig from Zero Res.
Because everybody wants to hear about carpet cleaning. It's a very, very exciting industry. Well, we about a year ago kind of jumped in the water regarding the CNG. We're a carpet cleaning company that travels primarily in the Twin Cities. We travel over 1 million miles a year in the Twin Cities with about 50 vehicles. So the environment, the cost, there's a lot of factors that kind of went into this equation for us. We employ 169 people, and we're moving to a new site in Richfield in March. So the primary issues here on this slide, savings, the engine life and efficiency, it burns at an octane of about 120, so it burns very, very clean, very hot. We have a huge abundance of CNG in our country. Right now the Bakken in North Dakota is flaring about 30% of the gas just because they don't have the infrastructure to put it in the pipeline and get it out and have enough end users to really maximize that use. That is ending, I'm told, in 2015, however, so that that flaring process will, the energy will be harnessed and used. Up to 80% lower emissions, and it's good for the Zero Res brand because we clean green, and so those are the reasons that we decided to make that move. In 2013, we spent about $700,000 on gas, 200,000 gallons of gas. It's about 6% of our revenue, and this is old. We now have 51 vans in our fleet, and we have 46 of them, I think, or 45, running on compressed natural gas currently. The first wave that we converted was 41. It cost about $450,000. So our vans run either, they're bi-fuel, they run either CNG or gasoline. We prefer the CNG, obviously. There are a number of reasons why we prefer the dual fuel. You can move the equipment from a van once the van is tired and we're going to get rid of it. We can move it to the next van. The tanks are certified for 20 years. So we run them for about 6 years. So we'll get three life cycles out of this CNG conversion. So if it costs $10,000 to convert it, you'd amortize that over about a 20-year period because the carbon fiber tanks are certified for 20 years. So this is the CNG in the back of the van. You can see on the left side there, that black box contains a 24-gallon carbon fiber tank, weighs about 120 pounds. So it really doesn't really disrupt. Well, our vans are full, as you can see. We carry a lot of equipment, fans. We carry our own water. We carry 230 gallons of our empowered water. So our vans are very full, but we were able to stay under the weight restrictions with that 120-gallon, 120-pound tank, 24-gallon tank. And this gets into some numbers. It's getting late, and I know we're over time here, so I'm not going to go through all the math equations, but I will say that it has turned the 6% of our revenue is fuel. So if it drops it to about 4%, that's a very, very substantial savings, allows us to hire more people, allows us to expand. So this does walk through all the costs, and I'm happy to talk to anyone if they'd like to do it offline. It's kind of boring. So it's cleaner. It's quieter. Our neighborhoods appreciate that. We don't make a lot of noise when we're cleaning carpet. We clean nights with our commercial crews. We clean about 42,000 homes this year. This has been covered for the most part. I'm coming in at the end of the program here. We clean with Empowered Water. The Empowered Water is water that's electrolyzed and oxidized. Powerful cleaning solution with no harmful toxins. So you can see how the CNG dovetails with our brand. We clean green, we drive green, we live green. It's good for the brand. So that's our experiment. That's where we are. That's why we've done it. And we're excited about it.
Thank you. I have one question. Do you use the power from the CNG to power the cleaning as well as the van transportation?
The cleaning equipment runs off the front end, runs off the engine with a PTO. So therefore, it is burning CNG. And we burn about 50% of our 200,000 gallons that we use, about 50% of that is used while we're not driving. We're stationary. We're cleaning.
Thank you. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And how long does a 24-gallon tank last?
We average about 14 gallons a day.
Okay.
Because it's hours and miles with us, because right. We're cleaning about 6 hours a day. Our average route is 85 miles. The combination of those two burns about 14 gallons on average.
Thank you.
Thank you. From the theoretical to the practical, thank you very much. Our next two presenters are professors from the University of Minnesota. Our first presenter is Will Northrup, who is a professor in the Mechanical Engineering Department, and he is going to talk about hydrogen as an emerging fuel. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for inviting me to come talk today about hydrogen. Just a brief background about myself. I'm a professor in the Mechanical Engineering Department at University of Minnesota. My research primarily involves internal combustion engine research and other such related topics, including emissions and alternative fuels. But I have some, in my prior days in career, I worked for a company called Nuvera Fuel Cells in Boston, Massachusetts, which was back in the early 2000s, essentially, when hydrogen was really being talked about as the hydrogen economy was really being talked about as the fuel of the future. What I'm going to tell you today is that this vision is still going on, and it's something that we should be at least aware of. And so I want to give you a little background on hydrogen. My slides have switched around a little bit, but I've just moved one slide, so you'll see. I'm sorry for the confusion. So I think it flows better. So the basics on hydrogen. So hydrogen itself is the most abundant atom on Earth. It makes up 75% of the mass of the universe. So it's a very abundant atom. However, it's a energy carrier, not a source. So when people say that hydrogen is an energy source, it's not, because hydrogen as two hydrogen atoms together doesn't exist naturally except from the sun. So we need to extract it from something, and it needs to come from some other source. Some of the advantages here, we can use hydrogen either as a combustion source. We can burn it in an engine, just like you could burn CNG, for instance, we've been talking about this morning. Or it could be used in a fuel cell, which is one advantage that I'll talk about briefly. So either way, when it's either combusted or it's used in a fuel cell, the only product is water, which is really an advantage for environmental reasons. There's no carbon associated with burning or consuming the fuel itself. However, a lot of the conversion to make hydrogen can result in some carbon emissions. So just like CNG, hydrogen must be stored either at pressure or cryogenically, so either like CNG or LNG. It has to be stored at pressure. It's a very low-density gas. However, that from a storage perspective, at high pressure, it has about 10 times the power per volume of lithium-ion batteries. So if it's used in a sort of fuel cell electric vehicle, which is what's being talked about, it still has a lot better storage density. I mean, you can get a lot more hydrogen or energy per unit volume of tank than you can for a battery technology. So it's still being talked about as an alternative technology, and some states are very aggressive. So who's doing what? So let's throw this slide in here to show that some hydrogen-powered vehicles are being brought out this year, in 2015. This year for the automakers is starts early. So Toyota, Hyundai, GM, Volkswagen, Honda all have been talking about bringing out fuel cell cars. Here's just a couple of examples. The Toyota fuel cell vehicle is there's a website on both of these, and a pretty flashy website. So they're pretty bullish on hydrogen still. So we're talking about, you know, the difference between, so Union of Concerned Scientists on the bottom right of the slide, you know, did a study showing gasoline vehicles about 20, this Tucson vehicle, so SUV, is about 25 miles per gallon. Natural gas, hydrogen, so natural gas-based hydrogen, so essentially making hydrogen from natural gas, yields you about 38 per mile per gallon gasoline equivalent, and renewable hydrogen, if it comes from, say, wind or something else, could get you up to, say, 54 miles per gallon equivalent. So advantages of fuel cell vehicles is they have good range compared to, say, battery-powered vehicles. Fast refueling, like you would refuel a CNG vehicle, so you have high-pressure refueling, and very high efficiency if you use a fuel cell system. Now, the disadvantages are that we have no refueling infrastructure, and I'll show you a slide that explains that. They're expensive. Also, the incremental cost for fuel cell vehicles is you know, in the thousands of dollars right now, so cost is very prohibitive without subsidy or government legislative action. And there are some safety questions about high-pressure hydrogen, but I think largely those have been debunked. Fuel cell technology, essentially, just quickly, this is a pretty busy slide, comes from the DOE website, converts. So hydrogen fuel cells essentially convert, take oxygen on one side, hydrogen on the other side of a selective membrane, and allows hydrogen ions to go one direction, so sometimes they're called proton exchange membranes. So the hydrogen proton goes this way, and that allows electrons to flow around and do work. So it's a very basic explanation of fuel cells. The advantages of fuel cells is that they operate at very low temperatures, and they can be they can operate at higher efficiencies than, say, an engine. So since they are operating at lower temperature, and they're subject to the same cycle that an IC engine with pistons moving up and down, they have some thermodynamic advantages. So they're still really being investigated, and research has really improved these fuel cells and brought the cost down, you know, 10 times in the past, say, 10 years, even with reduced funding environment. So what's going on with fuel cell vehicle fleet? Well, you can see here in this plot that these are all kind of alternative fuel vehicles. E85 is showing that there's, you know, there's quite a bit of these flexible fuel vehicles, mainly due to regulatory environment. But the hydrogen vehicles is that little teeny blip you can't even see on the bottom right. So there's really very, very small market penetration of hydrogen vehicles at this point. And compared to some of these others, you know, so CNG and biofuel vehicles are in the yellow, as you can't see on your handouts probably, but on the yellow on the yellow bar. And diesels are considered alternative fuel for light-duty vehicles. And you can see sort of the different amounts here. So hydrogen really is not playing a big role. However, this is mostly due to infrastructure, I think, and just the availability of these vehicles to meet low costs. So in terms of infrastructure, this is from Alternative Fuels Data Center. They're showing that there is only 11 public refueling stations in the country. And most of those are in California. Actually, I think if you follow the you know, about 9 of the 11 are in California, and mostly it's because they have a very strong program to encourage hydrogen, mostly in Southern California. So, but there are a lot of planned ones and some private ones will be operated by fleets, for instance. So infrastructure, as we talked about with CNG, is really the key thing. You know, if you have the infrastructure for hydrogen, the automakers will be more amenable to bringing out these vehicles. That's why in California it's a partnership between the automakers and the state government. So one thing that I want to note is that it's an energy carrier, not an energy source. And essentially, the production pathways are numerous for hydrogen. So since it's just H2, we can make it from renewable sources like solar, biomass, solar PV, wind, geothermal. We can also make it from nuclear power, nuclear heat. The heat from the nuclear reaction can be made, or from electrolysis. You can also make it from coal, which then doesn't have the carbon advantages, but you can also make it from coal. Petroleum and natural gas, and those can be done through catalytic reforming. So that's what sort of the basis of the hydrogen economy is, that if one of these things, natural gas price spikes one day, well, you're not dependent on that natural gas. You can switch to another source. Say Minnesota has really rich biomass resources.
Chair. Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, so is one of these more efficient or cost-effective than the other for producing hydrogen, or is it just the byproduct of the process?
Professor.
Okay, yeah, that's a very good question. Thank you. Right now natural gas is at a very, very low price. And so right now most of the hydrogen is being made through natural gas, what's called steam reformation. And that process yields hydrogen at the level of, say, $5 per gallon gasoline equivalent. But some of these renewable sources, such as what we're doing, so I put a little gopher here, where we're actually, University of Minnesota is doing some work. So at University of Minnesota Morris, they're doing some direct wind to hydrogen, and that has some real potential to lower the price even further and kind of compete with natural gas. So that's where we're at right now.
Madam Chair, so
Senator Tomasoni.
So in those cases, there has to be an installation that's attached to either the wind power or the biomass that is set up specifically for the hydrogen.
Professor.
Correct. Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So essentially, the facility either can be a distributed generation. So there's some discussion about whether hydrogen would be produced, say, at the, say, refueling station, or whether it would be produced centrally, say at a wind facility, and then compressed and then sent to distributed refueling stations.
Okay. And Madam Chair,
Senator Thompson,
help me out here, because it seems to me, I mean, just so everybody knows, those two cars you showed are pretty neat, but when we were over in Germany, we drove an SUV, and didn't General Motors make that SUV? Who made that SUV?
Senator Marty, do you remember?
You guys remember that? But, I mean, it looked just... I mean, so those aren't the only alternatives.
No. Thank you. Actually, I'm a former General Motors employee, so I should have put my, I should have been loyal. But essentially, General Motors does have a vehicle, though they haven't officially announced that it'd be available in 2015. They have an Equinox that they've been working on that I was somewhat involved in when I was at General Motors.
Okay,
yes.
So the one I drove over in Germany a few years ago was it a GM or?
Yes. Yeah. Probably. Okay. Yeah. Because okay. They had a version that was in Europe and they had a version that was here in the U.S.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for that question. So I can keep moving here and allow my colleagues some time to talk. So on the status, what's going on at the federal level is that the DOE has a hydrogen and fuel cells program, and it has for a number of years, and they have just announced an H2 First project, which really essentially has acknowledged that the refueling infrastructure is key to sort of getting the automakers to do more advanced research and getting hydrogen vehicles out in the market. So they have a target for $2 to $4 gallon gasoline equivalent. California here, I just kind of outlined some bullet points, has the most aggressive hydrogen infrastructure implementation plan. And they plan to have 48 stations in Southern California in place by 2016, enough to sort of allow vehicles to run around and refuel without running out of hydrogen. And in Minnesota, the Department of Commerce commissioned the Minnesota Renewable Hydrogen Roadmap. And beyond that, I think the outcome of that was that Minnesota would take a wait-and-see kind of approach and see what other states are doing and keep an eye on it. And so maybe that's why I'm here talking to you today about hydrogen. So one thing that I want to note here at the end and leave this slide with you is that hydrous ethanol is something that we're working on. But biomass resources in general Minnesota have a lot of potential for generating hydrogen. Also, biomass gasification and other things that we can do with the biomass or the large bioresources we have in Minnesota could also have potential for a hydrogen economy within Minnesota beyond the natural gas, paradigm. So right now we're doing some projects on hydrous ethanol, which essentially is ethanol that contains some water, and it's to expand the market for Minnesota biofuels. And I know we're talking about biofuels today. So right now we have projects sponsored by the Minnesota Corn Growers Association to do some hydrous ethanol work in dual fuel engines. and looking at energy savings with plants, say, like the CVEC plant in Benson. So what one proposal that we had last year to the Department of Energy was to investigate hydrocephanol reforming for vehicle hydrogen. So one thing we could do is we could combine sort of the biofuels infrastructure that we have in the state of Minnesota and the very established biofuels industry here and turn that into a hydrogen source possibly for bringing hydrogen fuel cell vehicles here to the state. So with that, I want to thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm worried we're going to lose you to California. Everything's going on in hydrogen in California. They have a lot of universities and much better weather. They do have earthquakes, though, so you have to keep that in mind.
It's lost. Right, right.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Professor, this hydrocephanol, there's several of us around here that have some serious ethanol plants in our Senate districts and our districts that we represent. But is this the same as isobutanol, but it's different?
Professor.
Madam Chair, thank you. So isobutanol is a separate molecule. So some of the plants and maybe in your district and others have been converting to isobutanol mainly because they've been incentivized by the chemical processing industry and also a potential for it to be used as fuel. Hydrocephanol essentially is to leave some of the water in ethanol. So when you make beer, essentially, or you make at some part of the process, you have lots of water in the ethanol. It takes a lot of energy to remove that water as it goes to what we can currently blend with gasoline. So what we're proposing is that you leave some of that water in the fuel and you can save energy at the plant and still use that as a fuel. And so we've done some work in looking at that.
So there would be...
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there would be a little retrofitting to the ethanol plant, but would it be a refueling system similar to what would be a completely different refueling system?
Madam Chair, thank you. So the refueling system would be largely similar, and from the plant side, we're investigating hydrocephanol as a co-product. So essentially, it would be some side stream of the reactor that's coming out. It wouldn't require that much change in plant infrastructure.
Right.
That's where we're going.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your little gopher is pointing at biomass and wind, which are Minnesota resources. That's good. But not at solar, and that's a good Minnesota resource. What would it take for you to look at solar as one of your production pathways?
Professor Northrup.
Yeah. Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, I neglected to mention that there is a professor in our department, Professor Davidson, who's working on some direct solar capture and had done some previous work in hydrogen. And I do notice, moving from Michigan, that it is sunnier in Minnesota, by the way, so thank you. It's colder, but sunnier. Yes, there is some work going on in hydrogen production, direct solar hydrogen production in Minnesota. However, the funding opportunities on the federal level have been somewhat reduced, and she's been mainly focusing on drop-in liquid fuels. But, yeah.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, I think maybe we should be thinking about funding opportunities from the state. Has anybody even pursued that I'll put it that differently. Perhaps people should pursue that as an opportunity because we do have good solar here. And we do have now locally made solar, which is even better. So.
Madam Chair, thank you for that. Yes, I think in the past the Department of Commerce has had some RFPs out in hydrogen back in say 2004, 2005 timeframe, and there was some aggressive look back when hydrogen was a popular alternative, and I think it would be very welcome to start looking from the state level at hydrogen either from a solar perspective, or from the biomass or wind perspective, because I think those are all important resources.
Representative Wagenius.
LCCMR is another opportunity, yeah, besides commerce.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Now, we've saved the best for last. Dr. Kittleson, I'm sorry that we are starting you at 11:05 when we originally predicted we'd be starting you at 10:40 this morning, but members, you're in for a treat because Dr. Kittleson is going to talk to us about dimethyl ether. And my understanding is I think the Volvo company has gone all in on dimethyl ether, one of the large companies. I thought it was a Swedish firm. So, Dr. Kittleson, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm going to talk about dimethyl ether and also briefly about renewable diesel, because we often hear about renewable diesel. My first slide lists a whole range of alternative diesel fuels, and I'm just giving those to you for background information. I won't talk about them. I'm going to focus, as I said, on renewable diesel and dimethyl ether. But if you have any questions about any of these other fuels, I'd be happy to answer them. Now, if we look at renewable diesel, it's made from the same materials that we make biodiesel from, animal fats or vegetable oil, waste cooking oil. All of those are feedstocks for making renewable diesel. It's a different process, though. It's a process that takes place in the oil refinery on a large scale, as opposed to relatively smaller distributed scale production of biodiesel. I'd like to just jump down and quickly compare it to petroleum diesel and to biodiesel. If you look at it compared to petroleum diesel, we have substantial reductions in all regulated emissions. We're talking about 30 to 70% reductions in regulated emissions. We also have substantial reductions in greenhouse emissions. When you compare to biodiesel, again, I want to emphasize it's produced on a much larger scale oil refinery as opposed to the more distributed scale production of biodiesel. It produces similar greenhouse emissions to biodiesel, but it produces, compared to biodiesel, more particulate matter, but lower NOx emissions. And finally, compared to biodiesel, it has better shelf life and better low temperature characteristics. There isn't a lot of use of renewable diesel in the United States, except renewable jet fuel. And most of the biomass to jet fuel is made by the same process. The same process, you can make gasoline, you can make jet fuel, you can make diesel fuel. I just came back from an Air Force lab where they were testing camelina-based jet fuel made from essentially this process. Okay, let's go on to dimethyl ether. University of Minnesota had an IRE-funded project to look at the prospects of producing bio-DME in Minnesota and also look at the performance of that fuel in a diesel engine. I've listed my co-investigators, the sponsors. We had a number of collaborators, a number of sponsors. So what's dimethyl ether? You've probably never heard of dimethyl ether. Well, you've got on the slide on the left, you see the molecule. It's a simple molecule. It's got a lot of oxygen in it. The physical properties are similar to those of propane. It's virtually non-toxic, it's not a carcinogen, it's not a mutagen, it has a very low greenhouse potential. What do we use DME for? Well, in the U.S., it's really only used as a cosmetic propellant because it is non-toxic, non-carcinogenic, etc. In China, it's taking off as a propane replacement, so it's basically biopropane. It's a very attractive diesel fuel. It runs at high efficiency, it runs without soot. So it's a diesel engine that you can't make soot with. That allows heavy-duty trucks to get rid of a $5,000-plus soot filter and all the maintenance issues associated with that. The downside is it's a liquid gas under pressure like propane, and so there's some fuel system modifications required. Now, Volvo was mentioned is very interested in dimethyl ether, and they did a study of basically seven alternative fuel combinations for use in trucks. And one of the interesting metrics they came up with was how many miles per acre. So you've got land to grow things. How many miles per acre can you get using these different fuels? And here they're comparing European biodiesel on the top, which is rapeseed methyl ester, and then ethanol from starch, ethanol from cellulosic, synthetic diesel, cellulose, synthetic diesel from black liquor, and this is where the Swedes are making DME. It's a byproduct stream in pulp mills called black liquor. And then finally DME methanol from either cellulosic materials, woody materials, or from black liquor, a pulp mill byproduct. And you see, if you compare with RME, you're talking about basically five times as many miles per acre of land with DME compared to that fuel. And you can compare with the others and see it still offers a very significant advantage. And if you look over on the right-hand side, we're looking at greenhouse emissions, and you see the two lows on greenhouse emissions are synthetic diesel and DME. And the synthetic diesel, again, you can get very low greenhouse emissions in the production process and so on. But if you use synthetic diesel, you still need a soot filter. And the energy cost of making synthetic diesel is also higher, and you get less yield per acre. So even though the greenhouse emissions are similar, DME still has a clear advantage. The next slide compares a whole array of biofuels, and I don't want to go through this slide. I gave you this slide for your own information. You can ask me questions about it if you wish. Let's talk about the current status of DME. Most of the DME worldwide is made from either natural gas or coal. As I said, in the U.S., it's used as a cosmetic propellant. Its use in China is rapidly expanding, and the first use is replacement of propane for cooking and heating. They're currently producing about 40 million gallons a year, but they're targeting their production capacity by 2020 will be 800 million gallons a year. That is equivalent to half the total U.S. propane use today. So that's an enormous scale up. Unfortunately, in China, they're making it from coal. And although this is a negative from the greenhouse standpoint, it's very positive from the health standpoint, because cooking on propane or a propane replacement is much better than burning a piece of wood and cooking over that in your kitchen. And that's what the Chinese are really trying to push. Bio-DME has really been pushed by the Swedes. And the first bio-DME plant was a pulp mill in Piteå, northern Sweden. And they made fuel for a fleet of Volvo trucks that drove around for several years on DME. Now, DME has come to the United States. Oberon Fuels is a California-based company that's going to make DME in relatively small-scale plants. And DME can be made from biomass, solid waste, methane CO2, and when I say methane CO2, you can, if you have waste CO2, you can react it with natural gas. If you have a landfill, the methane CO2 mixture is almost perfect for making DME. If you have a feedlot, the methane CO2 mixture is almost perfect for making DME. What about vehicles? Where are we going? Volvo, Isuzu, Shanghai Diesel, and Nissan all have prototypes running. I had a nice ride in the Isuzu DME truck. Very, very nice, quiet engine. Shanghai is going to introduce fleets of DME trucks, buses, and taxis. And Volvo has announced officially they're going to start production of DME trucks in the U.S. in 2015. What about production of DME in Minnesota? Well, we looked at the two pulp mills that use the process, Sappi and Bose. And if we converted both mills to use their byproduct to make DME, we could displace 2 to 6% of the diesel fuel use in Minnesota, or 8 to 25% of the propane use. If we go beyond pulp mills, because we really don't make that much pulp in Minnesota compared to other states, but if we look at our other biomass resources, just the existing resources without going to biorefinery or anything like that, we could produce roughly 120% of our current diesel fuel needs, or nearly 5 times our propane needs. I want to talk a little about its combustion properties as a diesel fuel. I just want to show you one slide. This is particle emissions. This is what we love to measure at the University of Minnesota. We've got a particle lab. I've measured particles all my life. Give me something, anything you want, I'll find some particles for you. But anyway, we compared the particle emissions from a diesel engine running on conventional fuel, same engine running on DME. With DME, it's about 2 orders of magnitude below the tightest current emission standard. With diesel, it's 1.5 orders of magnitude above the current tightest emission standard. That means you need an expensive soot filter on your engine, and DME eliminates the need for that. Okay, so finally, let me wrap up. If it's so good, why aren't we making it? Why isn't everybody rushing out and making DME? Well, one thing is, unlike ethanol, biodiesel, natural gas, there are no natural lobbies, no advocates. I mean, nobody stands to make a huge amount of money making DME right now. So it's very hard to get off the ground. Another thing, unlike biodiesel, unlike renewable diesel, you can't make a 10% blend or a 20% blend. You have to run pure DME, so you need a dedicated vehicle, and it has a different fuel infrastructure. You have to distribute it like propane. Now, you might say, well, that's more difficult than distributing diesel fuel, but the infrastructure for distributing propane, if you look at the cost of the propane distribution facilities, we're talking about a tenth the cost of compressed natural gas, or even E85. Propane distribution is quite cheap. It's just the thinking about things in a different way. And as I said, it's an excellent diesel fuel, but you do need some engine modifications. You have to have a pressurized fuel system. You need to change the elastomers. You need to use lubricity additives. And there's some potential issues with extremely small particles that aren't currently regulated. But I want to point out that these extremely small particles are also made by natural gas vehicles. They're also made by hydrogen-fueled vehicles. Anything that burns fuel and has lubricating oil makes these little particles. They don't come from the fuel. They come from the lubricating oil. They're currently unregulated. They could be an issue. But DME isn't unique in that aspect. We see in China there's a large production capacity, and the use is expanding rapidly. And they are going to start expanded use with trucks and buses. Volvo's put a huge investment in this. They bet a lot of money. And so we'll see what will happen. Thank you.
That was at Warp Speed. Thank you so much, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I'm used to diesel engines and so forth and understanding how diesel engines work, diesel fuel gets injected into a compressed state and it ignites there. Is this done in a gaseous form or in a liquid form, and does it ignite just under pressure alone, just like diesel fuel?
Dr. Kittleson.
Madam Chairman, thank you. It's exactly the same as diesel fuel, except you have to keep it's like propane, and so you have to keep it under pressure. And so the whole fuel system is pressurized. It goes to an injector. It's sprayed in as a liquid. But now it's a very volatile liquid, so it evaporates and mixes much more quickly. And as a result of that, you have a more complete combustion. You don't make soot,
sure.
And so it's soot-free combustion. But it's a diesel cycle. And, in fact, you probably know what cetane number is. Cetane number is the measure of how good the ignition quality of a diesel fuel is. And DME is in the range of 60 or so. That compares to typical diesel fuels in the U.S. are maybe 45. So it's a good diesel fuel. It's just these other issues that you have to deal with.
Representative Petersburg.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. And so if I understand it right, it is injected as a liquid form then into the engine. All right, thanks.
Other questions from members? I first heard Dr. Kittleson talk about dimethyl ether in 2008, and it's still fascinating. So thank you so much for taking the time to be here. I hope we're not making you late for class or making you miss lunch.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, members. We're going to break for lunch, and then my understanding is the bus leaves at 1:15 sharp. The goal would be if everybody's on the bus by 1, we could pull out at 1 o'clock to tour the facility in Shakopee. But we will leave at 1:15 whether you're on the bus or not. And our next meeting will be December 10th. With that, if there's nothing further from members,
where's the
Senator
bus out in front?
Anywhere will the bus leave from?
The bus will be out front, the state office building.
Any other questions for members? Thank you for coming, and this meeting is adjourned. I think it's.
Did I see something about a lunch?
Well, she said Annie is having people get it, my Julie.
Oh, okay. But just.
Well, incentives are always fun.
Yeah.
You know, the thing with the discussion about just letting the alternative fuels use the HOV lamp.
No, but we should talk about that. You know what? Will you show me your email?
Because the Fed's already said, you know, I mean, they're all in. There's California does. A lot of
tricky regs on HOV lanes from the federal government.
Yeah.
Well, they've already approved it for.
They didn't figure it out? Well, they were going to send it out like the other company.
Yeah, we could do that.
It was two, I think.
My daughter's not said
right here.
So I got that again. And it was